What's up, everybody? Welcome to Screen Geeks Radio, episode 103. It's weird to say that 100 part still.
It is, yeah. Can't believe we're pretty old.
Yeah. Anyhow, this is Dave.
This is Barry.
This is Ethan.
And Melissa was unable to make it. At some point, we will get her picks. But this is our big best of 2009 episode. I wanted to make sure we got it out before January was over.
Yeah. And forgive me, listeners, I have a cold, so I'm kind of operating at half speed, but I will give you the best I've got today, I promise.
Yes. And I don't know. I'm just out of it. It's all good. Anyhow, I'm trying to think. I don't even remember what I watched this week, so yeah. And I'm caught up on Chuck. That's what it is.
Hey, right on.
The show's getting better all the time.
It's a good show.
It's a way fun show. And I think, is that really all I watched? I think I was finalizing my top 10 list still, so yeah. Yeah, I think that was about... Yeah. All right. Yippee. That was me. Ethan, what have you been watching?
Barry, you do it.
Okay. Do you want me to do like my version of what you've been watching?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm Ethan, and let's see. I've been watching, I've watched season 3 of Baywatch, which is the one where Pamela Anderson gets introduced, and I really liked it, thought it was very good. let's see. I watched The Real Ghostbusters Volume 2, because that's when Arsenio Hall joins the cast, and I'm a big Arsenio Hall fan. And I also finished Dawson's Creek Season 5, because, you know, Joshua Jackson, I mean, we have a holiday named after him out here, so that was it. Barry, what have you seen? Well, Ethan, what I've seen... I actually watched, I took Julia to see The Young Victoria. She'd never seen it, and it was my second time seeing it. I still love The Young Victoria, great film. And last night, we watched The Russia House, one of the great underrated Sean Connery movies. It's Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer. It's a spy thriller, but there's no action, there's no sex, there's no profanity, there's no gunplay. It's basically the whole notion that spying is really just a lot of like middle-aged white guys sitting in rooms like listening to other people. So it's
so like The Good Shepherd.
Yeah, it's like exactly with The Lives of Others. It's like that. I love The Russia House. It's intellectual. It's suspenseful. It's really, really sexy. It's one of Michelle Pfeiffer's best performances. I mean, we've complained on and on about like Cate Blanchett's Moose and Squirrel accent in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And, you know, as much as I like that movie, I'll admit her accent was a problem. Michelle Pfeiffer's accent in this movie is magnificent. And she and Connery are so on fire. They've got such chemistry in this movie. It's a terrific movie, but it's kind of like, I mean, even The Saint is like a total action movie compared to The Russia House. The Russia House is strictly dialogue driven, but it's a terrific spy thriller. I highly recommend it. One of the great Sean Connery performances.
Very cool. Yep. Is that about it?
That's about it, yeah.
All right, Ethan. So what have you actually been watching this week?
Okay, I've got 4 movies written down here, and I'm going to do an eeny, meeny, miny, moe with them. I'll talk about The Fury.
Brian De Palma's The Fury.
Yeah, this is an interesting movie because it's each act of the movie is kind of a different thing. Like the first act is like this crazy action movie with Kirk Douglas. The second act is kind of this very slow-paced character piece with this teenage girl who has psychic powers. And the third act is like this crazy supernatural horror movie with people levitating and tilt-a-whirls going off their wheels and stuff like that. And it's even when the screenplay isn't that good, De Palma's direction, as always, is top-notch. So, yeah, I enjoyed it overall. And the final scene involving John Cassavetes is pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I got to say, I love the ending to this movie. It is so outrageous, but I dig it. I could watch the ending on a loop all day. Love it.
Next, I'll talk about... Paradise Lost 2 Revelations.
Oh.
This is the sequel to Paradise Lost, and one of the, well, I can you use the term characters for a documentary?
Or I think so, or yeah, something? Figures or subjects, yeah.
It was Mark Byers who was, in the first one was Mark Byers, who was the stepfather of one of the murdered young boys, and he kind of was, he was a bit of a supporting role, I guess, in the first one. And there's, well, I guess spoilers for the first one, but there's a revelation about near the end where you realize he may have actually been the one who was the killer. And it's a pretty scary moment. And in this, he really takes center stage. And this guy, he's insane. Like, I cannot stress how insane he is. Like, there's a scene where he's at the place of the murder and he's he's pouring gasoline over it, and he lights a match, and he goes on this rant about the West Memphis Three. It's like one of the scariest things I've seen in any movie, let alone like a documentary. And I went on Wikipedia after the movie, and I read some stuff, and I'm going to say the third one is going to be a pretty fascinating conclusion to this entire saga. So yeah, I definitely recommend it.
Very cool. And I'm so sorry for people who are hearing this in the back. My dog is just destroying this rawhide bone in the background. Sorry about that.
That's okay. To keep the child murder theme of this going, I also watched Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones.
Okay. And what did you think of that?
You know, I said this on Twitter, but there's a part of me that feels like this movie is a misunderstood masterpiece. Another part that thinks it's a interesting failure. Another part that thinks it's a hot, steaming mess. But I do like it, and I think the thing about this movie is it's a movie that demands repeat viewings, and it challenges you a lot. And I think it's a movie that's easy to kind of have a knee-jerk reaction to a lot of things from it, like the heaven sequences, for example. A lot of people say, oh, that's just Peter Jackson loving special effects and stuff. And no, I think it's just one small cog in a further kind of a greater tone and idea in portrait he's painting.
Yeah, I think it has more in common with how Gilliam used CG and Dr. Parnassus. You know, just because you have a CG environment doesn't mean that you're just all about the CG.
Yeah, and I think the thing, actually, if I had to compare this to any movie, it would be The Night of the Hunter, which was a movie which was really kind of crapped on when it came out, but over time, people saw what it is. Even the first time I saw The Night of the Hunter, I was kind of like, I just found it very bizarre, but I kind of realized how the theme of the film was the view of the child and such, and I think that's very much here. And I think that, I think it's a very powerful film, and maybe it is just me being a Peter Jackson fanboy. I'm not willing to admit that he made a bad movie, but I do genuinely think this is a complex film that demands a lot, and yeah, I liked it. And I had to give a shout out to Brian Eno, one of my favorite musicians of all time, who did his score for this movie is awesome. And they use a lot of his music in it. Like they use his piece, The Big Ship, near the end. And I think it's the most powerful scene in the entire movie. And Saoirse Ronan and Stanley Tucci, I think, give two of the year's best performances. But yeah, so it's a good film. And I think I really look forward to over the years watching it again and see people really appreciate it more. So yeah, I liked it.
Cool. Right on.
And the last thing, saving the best for last, I finally saw a Harmony Korine movie. I saw Gummo.
I have no idea what this is.
Moment of silence. I'm not a fan of Gummo.
I think it's a masterpiece. It's like a nightmare. That's the only way I'd describe it. You have to see. It's there's so much nightmare imagery, and I say that, but it's also funny and it's moving at the same time. Like, I think the thing is, I wouldn't really like this movie if it was just nihilism, but I actually think that Harmony Korine has a lot of empathy for his characters in the film, and that's what kind of anchors it a bit. It's not just nightmarish image after nightmarish image. And if you follow me, you'll see that I posted my favorite scene from the movie on Tumblr and on Facebook, which is when Harmony Korine, he has a cameo in the movie he has a scene where he's drunk and he's with a black midget who he's trying to seduce, and it's pretty good. I'll just say that.
And it's not your cup of tea, Barry.
Nope, not at all.
All right, fair enough. All right, well then, shall we go ahead and talk about what is hitting theaters this week?
All right, yeah, this week we got Extraordinary Measures with Harrison Ford and Brendan Fraser.
I'm already working around the clock! Sorry.
Nicely done. The Tooth Fairy, which no one worked around the clock, but everybody clocked in and took their paychecks. That's Dwayne Johnson, Julie Andrews, Ashley Judd, and Billy Crystal.
And the guy from Extras.
That's right. And Paul Bettany is Legion.
Ooh.
Or has a Legion. In limited release, you've got The Girl on a Train. Excellent film, starring Catherine Deneuve. And that was it.
All right.
Wasn't that Charles Darwin movie out in...
Oh, that's right. Creation. That's right. It was a Bettany double feature this week.
Yeah, because I just love the irony of him playing Charles Darwin and him playing a badass warrior angel.
A badass warrior angel protecting the Antichrist.
That's right.
That's the funny part of it all.
Go Legion. All right, and then DVDs this week. We've got, Michael Jackson's This Is It, the hit concert film. Jane Campion's Bright Star, starring Abbie Cornish. What?
No, I think of our interview yesterday where the Michael Jackson discussion came into play.
You know, we for those just tuning in, we interviewed Lloyd Kaufman yesterday, and, you know, there is not a politically correct thought that ever comes out of that guy's mouth.
Between the Michael Jackson joke followed up by the Pat Robertson joke.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It should be up in a day or two.
Wait, sorry, about Bright Star, you know, that isn't, it's not getting released on Blu-ray.
Really?
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's a visually beautiful film. It should be released on Blu-ray.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I like Bright Star. I mean, it's not my favorite Campion movie, but Abbie Cornish is fantastic in it. If she gets like a Dark Horse Oscar nomination, I'd be very happy. Good film. Bruce Willis and Surrogates. I like that movie a lot. Film that Dave and I both really liked. No one else saw it. Drew Barrymore's Whip It. Fun movie by Roller Derby.
Good movie.
Yeah, it's fun. Saw I'll watch 6. It. Yeah, good film. Saw 6.
We'll be talking about that a little bit later.
Yes, we will. Little Ashes. It's with Robert Pattinson. One day Homer will say, "I hope they serve beer in hell." Yep. The Boys Are Back, starring Clive Owen. One of the best films by the brilliant director Wim Wenders, Paris, Texas, with Harry Dean Stanton and Nastassja Kinski, available on Blu-ray, Criterion Special Edition. Got to see that.
Blu-ray and DVD, yeah.
Yes, I'll save our crap title, but let's move on to Pontypool, which all around, I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, Sean over at Film Junk put it on his top 10, and it sounds interesting. It's in my list.
And Ethan,
Netflix.
You're a fan?
Yeah, I liked it. It's a good Canadian movie.
Cool. Well, you know, there's so many good Canadian movies, but this is a really good one. Like, what's this one even about?
It's about this disc jockey, and it's just a normal day. And basically, he's hearing from inside basically these inclinations that there's a zombie apocalypse going on.
Nice.
And it's basically it goes from there, and it's pretty good.
I'd Excellent. Say. Okay. Very cool. And then The Real Ghostbusters Volume 2, featuring Arsenio Hall as the voice of Winston Zeddemore.
Yes, and it's a steelbook, too. It's a 5-disc steelbook.
You'll buy anything with a steelbook, won't you, Dave?
There are times I wonder.
And then finally, our crap title of the week, The Donner Party, starring Crispin Glover.
I just don't get that one.
I guess if you're going to typecast, you might as well cast Crispin Glover.
That's just a beautiful thing. It just, yeah.
Remember when he was like one of our great upcoming like serious actors?
No.
But he was like this really great edging.
Then he kicked David Letterman in the face.
Yeah. I think that's probably around the time that he kind of went downhill. It's too bad. No, because I think back to like River's Edge. I mean, he was really great, really edgy, really dangerous, really interesting to watch. And not so much anymore.
Yeah, then he became creepy thin hair man.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to some news. Do you want to just do yours first, Barry? Because I know Ethan has the lion's share of
Yes,
news.
He does. Oh, Ethan's got some good stuff. I'll just say they released, being Yahoo Movies, they released the trailer for Diary of a Wimpy Kid. This is based on the great webcomic that became a series of best-selling books. It has like a hand-drawn style to it. Really, really funny about this kid's nightmarish experiences as a grade school student and his really goofy friends and his really awkward moments. It's just absolutely wonderful, wonderful. And it looks like they've turned into an absolutely terrible, gutless, listless movie. And it looks just kind of like what they did last year with I Love You, Beth Cooper. We'll see. The movie opens up in April, but it looks just so terrible, and it was really disheartening to see them.
Who's in it? Anybody?
I think one of the Wilson brothers. It's got one name actor in it, but I can't remember who it is.
Yeah, wow. Probably Luke.
Isn't Luke in... Is he doing Marmaduke? Or was that Owen?
No, Luke is doing the AT&T commercials.
Man, what happened to the Wilson brothers? All right, that's it for me.
Okay, what you got, Ethan?
Writer and director have been hired for Paranormal Activity 2.
Your sister's a werewolf.
And isn't this the same guy who wrote and directed Saw 6, right?
I think it is, yeah.
Which is funny because, like, you know, like Paranormal Activity destroyed Saw 6 at the box office, so it's like...
Rightfully so, my dad.
It's like getting the director of Did You Hear About the Morgans for Avatar 2.
So is there anything good that could come out of this, or is this just going to be like Paranormal Activity 2, Book of Shadows?
Yeah, I can't see this being good, to be honest.
Electric Boogaloo.
I mean, minor spoiler, at the end of Paranormal Activity, they make it evident that a character has escaped and is on the loose. I mean, is that what they're going to do, bring back this character that's possessed?
Depending on which ending you've seen, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or do you think it'd be like a new family moving into that house? It'd be like at Amityville Horror, where it's just like new people.
I'm predicting that's what it'll be like. But either way, it won't be good.
Yeah,
nothing good can come of this.
No, it's a cash grab.
Fair enough.
Anyway,
go ahead, sir.
Mark Webb, director of 500 Days of Summer, will be directing the next three Spider-Man movies.
I don't quite know how I feel about this.
He definitely has visual panache, no question. He definitely has a style and a vision, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, but then again, this is a complete reboot, right?
This is.
So it's all in his hands what he does.
Are we going to have an animated musical sequence?
That'd be good.
Well, it'd be just like Spider-Man 3 then, right?
Oh, just less emo.
Less emo. I don't know. Well, you know, he obviously has talent. So, you know, if he has, you know, complete 100% say as to the new direction, it could be interesting.
Well, the thing is, I wonder if for him as a director, if you're in that position, do you want to do that and like dedicate the next how many years of your life to that franchise? Or do you want to like make your own movies? You know,
yeah,
that's kind of the question.
So he's officially signed on for three movies.
Yeah, and I think, did you read all the details that came about this? It's going to be like $80 million, and it's going to be set in high school, and it's going to like have a love triangle and stuff like that.
Man, it's sounding more and more like Twilight with web shooters.
Well, I guarantee it's going to be like season one of the OC. Like, Peter Parker is going to be Seth Cohen. Summer will be, you know, Mary Jane will be Summer. Gwen Stacy will be Anne, and Flash Thompson will be the Luke, and... Oh, I just outed myself, didn't I?
This just sounds just... I just don't get this at all.
I'm definitely looking forward to the six-year-old sitting behind me who's going to kick my seat for the entire movie because he's bored.
I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if it works for one movie, let alone three. But no, I give. You know, I hope Mark Webb has got something really great up his...
And
up his sleeve.
For Spider-Man, you just know it's going to be like Taylor Lautner wearing Coke bottle glasses. As Peter Parker.
My favorite thing is that in all the message boards, you know, for these stories, everyone's like, please get rid of the organic web shooters. I'm like, really? I thought we'd move past this.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Well, it's like, no nipples on the bat suit, please. I'm like, come on.
Well, it was just because it was just something to pile onto the other list of complaints.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
All right, how many more have you got, Ethan?
Let me count here. One, two. Two stories.
All right, go. I don't know. Go for it, sir.
IFC has IFC Films has picked up Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void and Todd Solondz's Life During Wartime, two films from two of the most controversial filmmakers working today. And I really wanted to mention this because I love both those guys and their films, and also because I wrote up about it on thefilmstage.com. So,
cool. Life During Wartime, isn't this the one that stars Paul Rubens?
Yeah, it's a sequel to Happiness, but with different actors in every role.
Cool.
Interesting.
I see that.
And IFC, they're doing what they do with a lot of their movies is they do a day and date theaters and video on demand with these movies. And I think that would work for Life During Wartime, but Enter the Void, I've heard that movie compared to like 2001: A Space Odyssey. So it's like, I want to see that in the theater, but
you can watch it on your iPod. Come on.
Yeah.
All right. And what's your last one, sir?
The trailer for the new Duplass Brothers movie Cyrus came out, and you guys watched it before the show. What did you guys think?
It looks kind of like a more serious-minded Step Brothers. That's what it reminded me of. But I think
I can see that, actually.
But you know, respectfully, though, I think it looks better than that. I really do. I think it looks very promising.
Yeah, it looks pretty stinking fun. Yeah. It's almost like, what if the 40, it's like another version of the 40-year-old version in some ways, too.
But again, like it a little more ambitious, and I mean, not just going for the yucks, but actually going for some real pathos and sadness, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And John C. Reilly singing the Human League song made me very, very happy.
That was great.
And I will end with the final thing. Slash Film reported on this. Who knows if this is true? I almost promise it's not. but apparently someone talked to one of the creators of the Night at the Museum movies, and there was discussion that the third one was going to take place in a Liberace museum. If they did that, I would be there.
Well, are they going to get Michael Douglas?
Is that still happening?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If it's not going to happen, he's still got to play Liberace at one point.
Absolutely.
So.
I mean, just that he, like, you know, Douglas, one of our great actors, that he was willing to step up and be like, I'll play Liberace for Steven Soderbergh. Yeah, I mean, he has to live up to that now. He has to. Like, that's one of those promises you have to do.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I really couldn't care less. But I'm like, if they did that, that they have found a way that would get my behind in this theater.
I don't know how children would... I don't know if that would be quite as appealing for small children, like a lot of piano solos, but yeah, that would be, you know, I'll bet anything that would be the best Night of the Museum movie.
Yeah.
No question. And you just have like Liberace like playing all these solos, and it's just like Ben Stiller sitting to the side, like crying his eyes out. And
they can take pictures from the sets of the Star Trek episode he was on, and you know, I don't know. I have no idea. Well, on that mind-numbing note, I guess we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of 2009. And yeah, we shall have some fun. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Dave. Great show. At Jonja.net, that's Jonja, we have everything to satisfy your sci-fi fan needs. If you look at this chart comparing... What do you mean there's no video? They're screen geeks. They don't have a screen? Well, how am I supposed to... I hired a Cylon to tell everyone about the discussions of sci-fi television and movies past and present. I guess I won't be needing you. You can leave.
By your command.
I mean, come on. I had Nichelle Nichols beam in to talk about our long list of exclusive interviews, including Zachary Quinto, Amanda Tapping, and the crew of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Hailing frequencies are always open at Jonja.net.
Never mind, Miss Nichols. Thanks for coming in. I don't believe this. Oh, great. Now here comes my special guest to tell people about Jonja.net's Flash Arcade. Forget it, man. They can't even see you. Oh, well. Maybe everyone will find their way over to Jonja.net to see and hear everything for themselves. Thanks for listening. Now back to Screen Geeks.
And we're back to talk about the best and absolute worst of 2009. We're going to start with the worst because, you know, we feel like starting from the absolute bottom of the crap heap and working our way up to the top. So, yeah, we'll start with our number 10s and then Dave will chime in and we'll...
Yeah, I only have a bottom five for some reason. Apparently, I was protected somehow.
So let's just crawl our way up out of the trash heap. Number 10 for me... Let's see, it has to be The Mark Peace Experience. This was a film that barely got released. It stars Ben Stiller and Jason Schwartzman. Sounds good, right? It's not. It's not funny. It's not clever. It's like a bad Saturday Night Live sketch about a guy who was the most obnoxious guy in high school. He's trying to essentially like reorganize a band that was really big. And Ben Stiller is his jerk of a teacher. It's just not funny. It's just really, really sad and pathetic. Imagine the movie Cyrus, except not funny. It's like that. Don't see The Mark Peace Experience. Don't let Ben Stiller or Jason Schwartzman fool you. It's a bad film. And that's my number 10. Ethan, what's your number 10?
I should note, before I do any of this, first off, there's going to be some movies on this list that aren't necessarily that bad. But the thing is, this year, I just... Like last year, I took all this time and I dedicated all this time in my life to watching the worst movies of the year, and I couldn't do that again this year. So there's just going to be some purely mediocre movies on this list. Like I don't have the time to watch Law Abiding Citizen. Okay, so
well, and if you want a truly comprehensive list, I'd highly recommend Master Worm's article over at Ain't It Cool.
Okay,
because he put some love into that hate.
Okay. My number 10 is 12 Rounds. Now, this is a movie I hate, mostly because I found the scene where the fat guy died really, really hilarious. Like, I was watching it while the rest of my family was asleep, and I had to hold it in not to wake them up. But just a pretty blah movie.
It didn't hold up to the promise of The Marine.
I know.
Well, the promise that we hold of The Marine, you know, The Marine is like people either forgot about it or they embrace it as the camp classic that it is. And you're right. The 12 Rounds it's pure mediocrity. It's a subpar Speed ripoff. That's all it is.
Very. It's a subpar Speed 2 Cruise Control ripoff.
Oh, I think Speed 2 was much better than 12 Rounds.
That's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right, let's go to number 9.
Number 9 for me would have to be I Love You, Beth Cooper. One of the funniest books I've ever read and one of the unfunniest laugh-free movies I've ever seen. Hayden Panettiere cannot save this movie. Christopher Columbus, a director who's made some of my favorite movies, he misses the humor of it. He doesn't go far enough. The movie should have been a hard R. They could have had a lot of fun with it. Instead, it's a completely disposable, useless teen comedy.
I'm glad I missed it.
Yeah. Ethan, number 9.
My number 9 is The Men Who Stare at Goats. Again, this is a movie I didn't hate, but it's just I really think this movie kind of coasts on its title.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Just it wasn't clever enough, it wasn't funny enough. I totally agree. Mediocre, not terrible, but like nothing special or memorable.
Yeah.
All right, we're cruising through these.
All right.
Well, we really don't, I mean, why would we really want to talk that much about these movies on our worst of list? At least until we get to like the top five. Then okay.
All right. Let's see. Was it number 8 now?
Yes.
Number 8 for me is The Last House on the Left, a remake that's even much worse than the original film. The original film, even though it was exploitive and certainly one of the drive-in movie classics of its time because of how far it went, how disgusting it was, it really did have some integrity and style brought to you via Wes Craven, one of his earliest films. The remake is just vile and sick and pointless. The acting is no good. The film really wasn't. I have nothing to say about this film positive. It's just a total waste of time. Don't even bother.
And for you, Ethan?
My number 8. Sorry, guys, fanboys. This is a movie I was rooting for, but honestly, it's not a lot better than like a Jason Friedberg, Aaron Seltzer movie.
I don't know if I can go that far, but I can agree that it is mostly a disappointment.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Like I liked it more than you, Ethan, but you know, I'll admit I have not thought about it a day since I've seen it. I've completely forgotten about it.
I walk by Walmart and see it in like the $9 bin. I'm like, oh yeah, that came out, didn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember Kyle Newman on the Slash Filmcast talking about his experience making the movie, how bad it was, and I definitely sympathize with him, and I definitely think a lot of things he said are reasons why the movie is not good, but at the end of the day, I can't make that many excuses for it. It's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
I like Kristen Bell in it, but yeah.
You know, I saw it with Melissa and Josh, and I think that's the only thing about it that has really stayed with me. I like the joke about Willow, where they're going through George Lucas' stuff, and like, Remember Willow? I think that was the one part of the movie I remember laughing really hard at, but hasn't stayed with me. It's no Road Trip.
Yeah. Yeah, the Trekkies and the Star Wars, that just was, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't come up at all.
Yeah. All right, number 7.
Let's see. Number 7 for me. Kind of going with obvious picks now, but you know, bad is bad. Obsessed. This movie made $75 million, which just shows like how the cult of Beyonce is alive and well. This movie was so awful. It's a ripoff of a movie that came out years ago with Timothy Hutton called The Temp, and The Temp was so much better. Also, you know, mix in a little bit of Fatal Attraction, Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Single White Female, and Beyonce's Single Ladies video, and it's still no good. The only part of this movie that's remotely memorable is there's a cat fight at the end of the movie between Beyonce and Ali Larder. It's kind of like who's the worst actress like cat fight of all time, and I got to say that was the one part of the movie that actually I found very interesting, and it kind of came alive. But it only lasts about 2 minutes, and the movie is over. Total waste of time. Even to watch this movie on an airplane would be a waste of your time.
Dang.
To quote Kathy Griffin, it sounds like a great movie to watch with a bowl of popcorn and a bunch of your gay friends.
Well, there you go.
No argument here.
All right. What was your number 7, Ethan?
My number 7 is The International. This was a massive disappointment because I think that Tom Tykwer's previous film, Perfume, is an utter masterpiece. But this movie is just so dull. There's no conflict throughout any of it. I remember I was in a video store a few months ago with my mom, and I saw someone renting it. I actually like felt bad for that person.
It's like the time when someone came up to buy The Happening. I was like, this is the only time I ever told someone, you don't want to buy that.
You know, the Guggenheim shootout, that's the only thing about the movie I liked. That's the only thing about the movie I remember. But you're right. It's like a boring, it's like a Jason Bourne movie without Matt Damon. It's just not interesting.
Yeah.
You mean a Jason Bourne movie without
Matt Damon?
See, I'm always going to use that drop if I can.
Good job, sir. Good job.
So we're up to number six.
Number six. All right, we're going down now. One of the biggest hits of last year, and one of the why do people throw $144 million at Paul Blart Mall Cop? You know, I wasn't the biggest fan of Observe and Report, but that movie had so much more ambition. It was nasty. It was original. And again, I don't highly recommend it. I really didn't like the film. I know you did, Ethan. But for Pete's sake, that movie had so much more to it than Paul Blart. Paul Blart was gutless. It was stupid. It was pointless. It was like a sitcom without a laugh track. Not that anybody would laugh at it anyway. Yes, I like Steve James, but the movie was completely unfunny.
And Kevin James?
Kevin James, what did I say?
Steve James.
Steve James, no, Kevin
James. Steve Jobs, I don't know.
That's right, sorry, yeah. Anyway, yeah, Paul Blart Mall Cop. I know they're going to make a sequel, but please, audiences, don't fall for it again.
Wait, it's the same, that audience of the movie, that movie is the same reason why Jay Leno is coming back to the Tonight Show.
Dang. There it is.
By the way, Ethan, did you see the last episode of Conan?
Yeah, I loved it.
I loved it too. That was great. I think his final speech, like I got really choked up. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, him playing Freebird with Will Ferrell in the back
was awesome. Great.
And you know, Robin Williams on Thursday night was pretty interesting by itself too. Did you see that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, like Robin Williams went off the rails.
Yeah, that was awesome. To just see how many things, how many rules he could break, and that little dance-off he had with Conan was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That was good TV.
Middle fingers flying, having to bleep every 3 seconds. Yeah. It was pretty entertaining indeed. All right. What was your number six, Ethan?
My number six was He's Just Not That Into You.
Mm.
This is a movie that... Throughout it's like this. It's like this smug movie that kind of is like, oh, I'm so insightful about dating. Ew, look how original I am. Then at the end, it just becomes this standard romantic comedy, and I felt infuriated by it. The thing is, I'm a fan in films of unlikable characters. Like I think if you can make a character that's unlikable but interesting, I think that's a major achievement. But every character in this movie is so just unlikable and dull and bland, and I hated watching it so much. Like, why should I be rooting for any of these people?
I can see that argument for sure.
Yeah, no argument here. Total mediocrity. What a waste of a fantastic cast. I mean, some of the cast members, I mean, I'm not a fan of the Aniston, but like Jennifer Connelly, for Pete's sake, and Scarlett Johansson, and really good cast, and totally given useless roles. It looks like the same thing we have in store for the Valentine's Day coming out, that movie. Yeah, it's like a sequel to that. You got these great actors, some of whom are Academy Award winners. Give them roles.
George Lopez.
Well, George Lopez deserves whatever he gets. But, like, I mean, for Pete's sake, I mean, Jamie Foxx, like, really good actors who just, like, completely wasted taking roles that, like, most sitcom actors wouldn't even subject themselves to.
And to be fair, I know I stuck up for this when it came out. And I thought it was a decent movie, but I you know, I don't like it enough to try to defend it. Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Number five. Now I get to join in with the fun.
There you go. All right. Number five for me is a number six, Saw Six. I thought Saw Six was just so terrible. In all fairness, I've only seen Saw 1 prior, but you know what? Saw 6 has so many flashbacks, I really felt like it never ceased to keep me up to date what was going on. In fact, it even had flashbacks to scenes that just happened 5 minutes ago, just in case I fell asleep. But I thought the acting was bad. I thought the story was completely nonsensical and bizarre. Lots of gore and guts and things and that are splattering all over the place, but you know, gore galore is not scary. The movie wasn't scary. It wasn't suspenseful. I know this is not the end of the series. We got Saw 7 coming out.
But in 3D.
I hope this part 7 either has something to offer or it just completely ends this cycle altogether, because whatever worked for Saw 2 and 3 is not working anymore.
Well, and even 4 and 5 are decent. 6 is where it goes off the rails completely for me. They get away from who Jigsaw is in any way, shape, or form. Well, there's a couple scenes a little bit, but overall, it's a garbage movie. Like, I was wary going into 5, but it was still, there was something to be said about it.
Yeah.
But this was just bad. And the ending, I hated the resolution of the person, the protege, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
It's all, the thing about Saw is that if you're going to see Saw, there's something interesting about the characters there occasionally. That ceased with Saw 6. So I'm done. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Choking on Saw 6. I'll say this really quickly. Like, I know it's probably just a bunch of guys in a room, the screenwriters going, okay, like, I'm sure they got all these charts as to who's connected to what and all the plot twists they could throw out, all the things that they've set up. It just seems like they're kind of running out of ideas at this point.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. Yeah, I thought this was a pile of garbage. It will appear on my list. All higher right. up.
Okay. Okay, Ethan, you're up.
Wait, we're at five?
Number five, yep.
Okay, my number five is Knowing. This is a movie I could admire a little bit of it, but at the end of the day, terrible screenwriting, terrible acting, terrible dialogue, terrible visual effects, terrible cinematography, and kind of doesn't just... I just can't cut it that many breaks. Sorry, it's just a very... like, I need a little more foreshadowing than... it's awfully hot for October for the resolution. I'll just say that.
And Barry and I talked about this before we even called you, Ethan. And you know, it's like you said when we first talked about it. The last 5 minutes are really interesting, and that's probably the only reason it's probably not on my at least. It's on probably on my list of disappointments, but yeah, that's the only reason I probably kept off my awful list.
I like the film. Melissa is with me on this one. I really like Knowing. I thought it was different. I thought it was ambitious. I thought it was very weird. And I liked the chances it took. You know, you don't have to see a lot of Hollywood movies take the chances. Not everything worked, granted. Some of it was just campy, and some of it was just incredibly silly. But like a good Twilight Zone episode, I thought it actually had the nerve to carry out its ambition.
To me, the box is everything that Knowing tries to be. But oh well.
I would reverse those two, but I gotta say, The Box, that is unlike He's Just Not That Into You or Fanboys, The Box is one of these movies that has stayed with me, and I will give that movie another chance when it comes out. I've not stopped thinking about The Box.
Interesting. I get to jump in on the list. This is like the beating a dead horse, but oh well.
Oh well.
X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Oh, here we go. Here we go again.
Like, here's the funny thing. I keep telling people, like, the opening credit sequence is awesome, and like the 2 minutes where Deadpool is awesome. The rest of the movie is completely disposable. It pretty much throws away everything that happened in Wolverine, in the X-Men movies, in the freaking X-Men universe, and amnesia bullets. That's all I need to say.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bad movie.
I didn't mind it. I thought it was lame and forgettable. Summer movie, trifle, but nah, I can't defend it. You know, it's one of these movies I can't get excited enough to defend it, but I didn't mind it.
Yeah. I mean, Liev Schreiber was even good as Sabretooth. There's like these... The problem with Wolverine is that the few bright points that there are make the pile of crap that is the rest of the movie just that stink that much worse to me.
I'm kind of like with Ethan. Like, to me, this is one of these movies that it's just so mediocre. It deserves to be on a top 10 list just because it deserved to be so much better. And it had so much things, so many things going for it. The material is so good. The actors are so good. It could have been so much better than just a disposable summer movie ride. That's really all it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to number four.
Well, did Ethan say his number five?
Yeah.
Oh, that was Knowing. I'm sorry. Knowing. Yeah. All right. Well, number four for me, easy pick. Katherine Heigl had the nerve to pick on Knocked Up, saying it was sexist. She had the nerve to say she didn't like Grey's Anatomy because the writing was no good. And then she stars in a movie she produced called The Ugly Truth with herself and Gerard Butler, who himself has not made a good movie. Well, I would say since Dear Frankie, but that's just me. Shame on her for making that movie. The Ugly Truth is one of the worst romantic comedies, and I've seen a lot of them, and I'm very defensive of chick flicks, but this is just bad, bad, bad. It is degrading to women. It's degrading to men. It is degrading to the human species. This movie is just such crap. It just brings out the worst in everyone involved. It has is a terrible script. It is completely sexist and brainless in ways that Knocked Up never would be. And for me, this is the low point that Katherine Heigl needs to climb out of. I forgave 27 Dresses. Completely watchable, disposable, but workable romantic comedy for what it was. This was just beneath contempt.
When discussing my poor love life with my good friend Anne, she said she could be my dating coach and it could be like the Ugly Truth but in reverse. Is that a good thing?
No.
All right, then.
I'm terribly sorry that came up for you, man. Gosh.
All right, then. Well, what's your number four, Ethan?
The aforementioned X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Oh, man.
This is a movie that's made... This is the definition of a movie that's made purely to meet a release date.
Mm. Absolutely. Kind of like X-Men Last Stand was.
Yeah, it's just a movie that's so offensively middle of the road. It's like the kind of movie it ends, you don't talk about it. You're like, you're at the end of the day, what did I do to, oh yeah, we went to a movie. What movie was it? Yeah, it's...
would it kill a movie to actually have an ending and not to have an ending that's setting everything up for future franchise, installments?
That sets up things to screw up continuity of prior movies and make Xavier look like a boy toucher and
Not every movie
has to end.
Well,
that's your opinion, Dave.
you're right, Barry. Not every movie has to end like Mac and Me.
Well, that's one of the most definitive endings of all time. But I do believe that you should at least have some semblance of an ending. I mean, that's one of the reasons.
The joke was because at the end of Mac and Me, it says, "We'll be back." So.
Well, it's just like, to me, like Wolverine didn't even feel like it had an ending. It was like setting everything up for the following movie. I don't know. I like a movie that at least has some kind of, I mean, that's one of the things that I liked about Terminator Salvation. It actually had a real ending. I mean, that's like, it's over, the end. If they come up with a sequel, it's completely starting from zero. If they ever make a sequel.
Yeah.
Well, apparently you can buy the franchise for like $30, so.
$30, all right. It's on sale now.
Oh, it's up to me to number four now, isn't it?
Yep.
Well, Ethan and I are just kind of trading back and forth. My number four is 12 rounds. Mm. There's something about a movie when it becomes so bad that it becomes good, like The Marine. when Robert Patrick knew he was in on the joke in that movie.
Yeah.
No one was in on the joke in 12 rounds. This was made as a serious action movie, and I don't understand why.
I don't know how serious it was, but it just wasn't that fun. It just hasn't stayed with us at all. I think it had moments that tried. I think it tried for that kind of campy WWE films, like level of silliness and, like high five each other while drinking your beer movie. But this just wasn't that. It didn't get that.
No.
No. And Rennie Harlan directed it. What a letdown. What a great director. This is the guy who did The Long Kiss Goodnight and Cliffhanger. And
this was on the level of like A Man Apart with Vin Diesel for me. Mm. Except A Man Apart crossed over into that so bad it's hilarious.
I never saw Man Apart.
Did anyone else watching the movie kept thinking that the bad guy was the lead singer of the Flaming Lips?
If the bad guy was good, I think it would have helped the movie so much. Because the bad guy was a worse actor than John Cena, which is really saying something, I think that was one of the reasons why this movie was such a failure.
Just so bad. It's just so bad.
It's so disappointing. Because, man alive, I mean, like... They should have gone for like the Marine level of campiness and over the top, but it just didn't quite get there. The one part I really liked was when John Cena uses a boat to stop a car. I thought that was very inventive.
Yeah.
But otherwise it's the kind of movie that plays on TNT a Sunday afternoon you have on while you're folding your laundry.
Yeah.
And maybe you watch it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, that fat guy free fall scene.
That's right. See, it wasn't that bad after all. So,
now that I'm through number four, like these are movies I just thought were really disappointment and bad movies. From here on out, these are movies I legitimately hate. So, yeah. What's your number three, Barry?
Well, thank you for setting up that way, Dave. Because, yeah, for me, like, it goes, because I have a 1 to 5-star scale, hence that's, I always do 4 stars, but Maui Times says 5 stars, so I do 5 stars. These are all movies I gave either 0.5 star or no stars or, like, don't even deserve to be in the sky. Number three for me is All About Steve. All About Steve is a movie where we're supposed to laugh at the fact that Sandra Bullock is this clingy, obsessive, scary girl. I mean, much scarier than Ali Larder in Obsessed, by the way. Within the first 10 minutes of the movie, she is date-raping Bradley Cooper, and we're supposed to laugh about that. Supposed to find that so funny, because it's Sandra Bullock, and she's so cute, and everybody loves Sandra Bullock, right? No, she's terrible in this film. This is the worst film she's ever done. This is her worst performance. She produced this movie, by the way. There is a subplot in the movie about a guy who likes to carve people's faces onto apples. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't amount to anything. It's just this weird, whimsical touch. There's a subplot about a woman who still has a penis. There's a subplot about this cult that's following Sandra Bullock around. We're supposed to start rooting. I mean, this movie is awful in interesting ways. It sounds like a
Harmony Korine or Todd Solondz movie gone wrong.
I would say it's like Leonard Part 6. It's one of these movies. Ooh. That it's awful in ways that, like, this is interesting. This is bad in ways that have never been bad before.
They found new ways to suck.
It's all new ways to suck. Yeah, this is a terrible film.
All right. So is your list heading this direction too, Ethan?
Yeah, we're getting the knives out. We're sharpening them. We're yeah.
All right. What's number three for you?
Dragon Ball Evolution. I honestly don't even really remember anything about this movie other than the fact that I gave it a 0 out of 10. So it's at number 3.
Yeah, it's pretty special. Just hey, you know what? It's not the only cartoon video game movie that's going to be talked about here shortly. So yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll just get it over with. Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen is my number 3. It's just so bad. I mean, it is literally offensively bad. Like, wait, I own the first one.
I just want to say that I remember when we did the show, you're like, you know, I had some fun with this movie.
I kind of did, but like the more I think about it, it's like when you go to Cinnabon and you're like, ooh, you know, it's like sweet, gooey goodness, and then it just sets so badly and it just leaves, yeah, just bad
but
things to your system.
To Cinnabon, though,
I love Cinnabon, but, you know, you're right, it is bad because I actually will have a Cinnabon again at some point in my life, but... You know, it's just, it's like, probably better way to put it is like when you have too big, you know, that's just going to be, I was going to make a Dairy Queen Blizzard joke, but if you have too big of one and then the reaction physically afterwards, we'll leave it at that. Mm. Yeah, that's kind of what it was with Transformers. Like there is a couple things that were kind of sort of fun, but the more I think about it, like I own the first one, never buying the second one. Mm. Never, ever. Ever.
Even if they have like a box set of the three films and the third one's really good.
Oh, yeah. It's going to bring a third dimension to suck and we all know it.
Well, you never know.
I think we do.
Yeah, we do. We do. My optimism was there for like 2 seconds and gone.
Yeah. It's moved up steadily. It's just, especially after seeing G.I. Joe. Mm. I mean, G.I. Joe shows that what you can do with a camp when it's done right.
And it could be an hour shorter, and it could actually be good fun night. And actually like good spirited and you know cheese, but like good cheese, not like movie popcorn, nacho cheese.
Then again, like the Blizzard, yeah, sets bad.
There you go. Yeah, we're going with like the bad food.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's like the double quarter pounder I had at midnight tonight, but
yeah,
isn't sitting too well with me.
All right, shall we move on to number 2?
Number 2, appropriate.
Go. There's no segue. Just go.
All right, Orphan. You know, horror movies with little kids are a standby. I love the original Village of the Damned. Can't say I'm a big fan of The Omen, but you know, I do like those types of movies. The Good Son, I like. Joshua was pretty good. Orphan, waste of really good actors. Peter Sarsgaard, why are you in this movie? Vera Farmiga, why are you in this movie? Leonardo DiCaprio was the producer of this film. I can't imagine what the heck he was thinking. It's one thing to be scary. Again, like I like horror movies that are actually scary and suspenseful. Imagine that. This is just about the disgusting things we can have a child do, like set another child on fire while a little girl watches, or smash an adult's head in with a hammer while another child watches. Or try to seduce a parent while dressed up like Britney Spears. I mean, this movie is just vile, vile. It's sunk below the bottom of the barrel. Absolutely just vile and sick with a twist ending that was so stupid because it could have been anything. It wasn't one of these twist endings that leads up to it. It's one of these twist endings that they just came up with and said, let's just inject this and see if people go for it. And they're taken back by it. And I think people were because it made $40 million. But I got to say, this is one of the few horror movies where I was just genuinely offended. I thought it was just so disgusting and such an insult to a genre that could be so imaginative and so frightening and so inventive. For all the problems I had with Paranormal Activity, that film is just miles and miles better and more inventive and intelligent than anything Orphan is. Orphan is just garbage, complete, total crap.
Yep, the knives are out. All right. Ethan, what's your number 2?
My number 2 is The Informers. Now, I like Bret Easton Ellis a lot, but this kind of made me look, do I really like Bret Easton Ellis? Do I really like him? Because I found this movie just to be such just a boring waste of... It's a movie about nothing. It really, nothing happens, and I'm fine with that movies if it's interesting, but nobody in this movie is interesting. Nothing. There's not a single thing in this movie that's interesting. I don't know how anybody can find any of this. It's so bad. Well, except Amber Heard's boobies, but...
All right, then.
I liked Brad Renfro's performance. That's about the only thing about the movie I liked.
He looked well. I all due respect to him, but I can see why he died. He looked terrible. Like he looks
like
so
he was
bloated.
Like he was in bad physical health.
Yeah, like, I felt bad for the guy watching it. Not just because of how bad the movie was, but...
All right, then.
Soundtrack's good. I actually own the soundtrack to it. But I'll never watch the movie again. never again.
My number two would be the aforementioned Saw 6. Hate it. You know, we've talked enough about it. I really don't feel the need to talk any more about it. It took something where something was somewhat creative and interesting and just flushed it. So, yes. And here it is, the drum roll. Our number one worst movies of the year. What is yours?
Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. I thought it was just a personal insult to me. I felt like Michael Bay made this movie to hurt me. I feel like he knows all the things I love about movies, and he says, well, I'm just going to jack with Barry. I'm just going to totally screw with him. I don't like him, and he doesn't like my movies. So you know what? I'm going to make him suffer for all the things he said about Transformers 1. And he did. He made me suffer for almost 3 hours. In fact, 3 hours, including the commercials, which were better than the film. I always love to point out that 10 minutes into the movie, the kitchen's exploding, the little gremlin robots are wrecking havoc, Sam Witwicky's parents are screaming and overacting, dogs are humping on the lawn, Megan Fox shows up, immediately starts taking off her clothes for seemingly no reason, and the house explodes. And Sam Witwicky hasn't even gone to college yet. Like, this movie just wants to insult you, assault you, and bore the crap out of you, and it hasn't even started. I really felt like... how Malcolm McDowell felt in Clockwork Orange when he's strapped to the chair and he has his eyes pinned open and he's going, please no. That's exactly how I felt watching Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. I think it is beyond bad. I mean, I could just go on and on and talk about John Turturro in a thong or the old Transformer with a cane who could with the teleport.
Beard of leadership. Yes.
Just this movie is just one big mistake after another. It is a huge waste of time. It is one of these movies, you know, because I'm not, I swear, like, I'll be honest. I am something of a snob, but I'm not such a snob that says, like, well, you know, American movies, we don't make good movies. This is one of these movies where I go, God, look at the crap America is making. Look at the crap Hollywood is making. This is one of these movies where I do, like, kind of get in my high horse and go, look at the garbage that Hollywood is strewing out and spending $300 million for. This is a movie that, you know, after it's over, I actually felt like, you know, I don't really want to see another movie for a few days. And I love cinema. I have a passion and a love for this genre, for all film. So when a movie can make me not want to see another movie again for a long period of time, I know it's done its damage. And this movie hurt.
All right, Ethan, your number one or number two, depending on how you want to look at it.
My number one is Transformers Revenge of the Fallen.
Good
and
man.
Honestly, like Barry, like this movie makes me feel like a Vietnam veteran. Like, I just, like I'll be just tossing and turning back, no, mud flapping skids, no, in my bed and just jolt up and be sweating and be like, oh, I'm not in the theater watching it anymore. There were points in this movie where I wasn't watching. I just turned and looked at the audience and looked at the grins on the faces of the people, and I thought, why? What? 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 What is there in this movie that is entertaining? And when it ended, I stood there in my seat, and I looked at all the people going, oh, that was sick, and the people who clapped at the end, and I was like, what is happening to our society?
You know, one of the reasons I love to go to the movies, Ethan, is to have that shared experience with the audience. But when you, like, have contempt for the people around you, that's just not good. That's not healthy. But I totally understand what you went through, because I had this exact same thing. People applauded, a big, fat round of applause when it was over. And I thought, are they applauding? Because I wanted to applaud, too, but only because it was over, not because I liked the movie.
That's when you can join in with the audience, just not for the same reason.
Right.
Yes. Wow, I got mine out of the way earlier. That was, wow, okay.
Well, Ethan, did you have anything else to get off your chest? I mean, this is like the last time we'll talk about Transformers 2 in a while. Anything else you wanted to add, or?
I just want to pretend like that movie never happened.
See, that movie for me this year was Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li.
Oh. That came out in January, right?
I think.
The January rule sometimes does apply.
Yeah. Oh, boy, did it apply. There's no street fights in Street Fighter. I just feel the need to point this out.
That's funny.
Really? Is
there street fights in the movie?
No, not really. No, not. There's fights in dojos and stuff, but no, not any street fights. And how do you try to get, okay, from a very Chinese-looking baby to Kristen Kruick, who has vaguely Asian features at best.
That's insulting. I hate that crap.
There's no Ken. There's no Ryu, which, let's face it, that's what Street Fighter is. You know, I wish that we had Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's how much I hated Street Fighter. Chris Klein is in it, and he is awesome in this. I know that this movie is going to be awful. Like, he just goes nuts on the hamming it up.
Comparable to his performance in Election?
You know, he makes the guy in Election look brilliant.
Wow.
Yeah, it is just awful. Like, it fails on every single level. Neil McDonough is awful as this guy who kind of has a Scottish accent. Like, we make jokes about how Kevin Costner's didn't have a voice, a British accent at all, and he tried once or twice.
In Robin Hood.
Yes. Oscar caliber acting compared to Neil McDonough. Wow. This movie, it fails on every level.
He really tries to speak with a Scottish accent?
Yes. It's great. It pops up once in a while, and you're just, what? Why even bother?
Isn't Michael Clark Duncan in this too?
Yes.
Or is it Michael Duncan Clark? I always get it wrong.
No, it's Michael Clark Duncan.
Clark Duncan? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he plays Saget, and
Saget?
Well, yes. He actually ends the movie doing Rolling with Saget. And no, this movie, I was like, I felt upset that people wasted a dime on the budget on this movie, because you really didn't need to spend anything on this. It was bad. The previous Street Fighter movie is such a superior film in every way, shape, and form.
Wow.
And that's saying something.
That is saying a lot. Man alive.
Oh, it's just so bad. Oh, it hurt. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, see, now that we've got this done, we can talk about the stuff that we liked.
Nice. Oh. Well, I want to add to what you said really quick, though, Dave, because I appreciate, like, great performances in bad movies, and I guess, like you would say, Chris Klein maybe applies for that.
Like, Chris Klein wouldn't be out of place in Port of Call, New Orleans.
Okay.
That's how just out there it is.
Okay. Because, like, for me, I got to throw this out because I was very impressed. Out of all the, like, the great performances in bad movies I saw this year, the one that I loved so much was Julie Benz in Boondock Saints 2, All Saints Day. She literally takes over for Willem Dafoe. You know, this is Julie Benz from Dexter, mm-hmm. and also the fourth Rambo movie. She's a beautiful actress, and she goes all out in a campy, gloriously campy performance that I thought was the best thing about Boondock Saints 2, a movie that just missed my top 10 list of the worst films.
What are you going to say, Ethan?
I wasn't going to say anything.
Oh, okay. All right.
Did you have one for that, Ethan? Pick for, like, the best great performance in a bad movie?
I guess the cast of Nine.
Yeah, that's a good pick.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about our top tens. Let's just skip to that. We'll do a few honorable mentions at the end, and we'll go from there. So let's just keep going with the same order and work from 10 on up.
All right. Number 10 for me was Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker. Fantastic movie. Great action film, but above all, a really smart and thoughtful movie about what soldiers go through and basically the mindset of a soldier. Jeremy Renner's performance is one of the surprises of the year. What a wonderful performance. And yeah, I love the film. And congratulations, Catherine Bigelow, for coming back in such a big way.
Should have won at the Golden Globes, just saying.
Yes, it should have. She should have won Best Director.
All right, Ethan.
My number 10 is The Box, which I really loved, but when we talked about it on the show a few months ago, I was, as usual, very inarticulate. And I was like, oh, well, I liked it because that... But I liked it.
Remember that one time in the movie? That was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I liked that this movie took kind of the setting of like a 70s Spielberg movie, but combined the strangeness of a David Lynch film. And it's very much, I agree there are things in it that are maybe ill-advised in some ways, but I just loved watching Richard Kelly take me on this strange, strange journey. And I think it's one of the few. I think this is a great year for science fiction. I think this is maybe the best one because I think it honestly has the most intricate themes of any film of any film this year about damnation and salvation and morality and such. And yeah, it's a great film.
I agree. This has been a great year for sci-fi.
Yeah, and I got to say, I wish more people did see this movie, because even though I have some real issues with it, it stayed with me. The ending is one of the nastiest endings I think I've seen in a long time. I'm like, wow, this is clearly not a movie made by a Hollywood system. This is clearly Richard Kelly expressing himself and coming up with ideas, some good, some bad, but like Southland Tales, he's taking chances.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Well, I guess it's to me, huh?
Yes, sir.
You know, there, like I said, so many good sci-fi films, and in a way, I feel bad for making this my number 10, because they're probably, you can make arguments that District 9 and Moon were better movies. I think very, very, very strong arguments, but I don't know that I, probably just about the most fun I had at the theater this year was Star Trek. Just, it's, the movie wasn't even made so much by the script, but by the direction, and the acting in this film was just phenomenal, because you found ways to do homages to the original cast without necessarily doing a beat by beat impersonation. Probably Anton Yelchin is the closest one, but even then it was still kind of his own take on it. And really, one of my favorite performances of the year was Carl Urban as McCoy. I mean, he inhabited Bones in ways that I didn't think was possible. I just thought it was amazing. Just tons of fun. So
Carl
much fun.
Urban. Who would have thought Carl Urban would be up for that?
No kidding. Dude from Doom. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure I'll get a little crap for that, but I just had so much fun at that movie. Yeah. 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 And do you want to say anything about it all, Urban, or not really? Are you going to mock me for putting it in my top 10?
No, it's a great movie. Rewatching on Blu-ray, the thing I really realized is actually like you said, how awesome the cast is. Like, every single character has at least their moment.
Yes.
And in a tight 2 hours, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, because there's a lot to get through, but they still found a way for the movie to breathe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll just say really quickly, not since Star Trek VI have I found a Star Trek movie to be so emotionally engaging. As Ethan just said, all the cast members have their part in their place. They're not just a part of like, well, you know, let's give Uhura a line here and Chekhov a line here. Everybody was part of the ensemble. The villain was compelling. The story was compelling. The movie was emotionally resonant. Like, I mean, I was bawling after the first 10 minutes. And yeah, I know a lot of people who are not Trekkies who did the exact same thing.
Every time I get choked up. Every time I've watched that movie. I watched it like 5 or 6 times now.
It is a magnificent movie. It's much higher up on my list than yours, but I'm glad it's on your top 10 list. I think this is by far one of the best films of the year.
Yes. Cool. All right, let's go to number 9.
For me, it was almost just a matter of where to put it on the list, because it is so terrific. Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, what a wonderful film. What a surprise. A movie that was advertised as being an ultra-violent Brad Pitt movie was actually thoughtful and at times visionary and really just a wonderful piece of storytelling above all. This is Tarantino, like, just going from scene to scene, creating these wonderful scenes that would be, like, really great short stories all by themselves. Everybody talks about how good Christoph Waltz is, but really, I don't think there was a bad performance in this movie.
The
ensemble was excellent.
Diane Kruger was great.
Diane Kruger and Till Schweiger have never been this good before or since. And, you know, and I mean that with all due respect, because they are fantastic in this movie, and I think they finally had roles that are made for them, as opposed to stuff like Driven and National Treasure, where they're just kind of like part of the cog in the machine. But no, they're both so good in this. And you know, what can you say about a movie that really the ending couldn't possibly deliver more for you?
Yeah.
The climactic scene is everything you wanted. For me, it belongs at number 9 for me, because I had, as I've mentioned before, I had all these issues about the way the film ended. I think a character stating this might be my masterpiece, and all of a sudden Quentin Tarantino's name gets splashed on the screen was a little just a little too egotistical for my taste. But you know what? Everything that came before it was excellent. This is I think his best movie in a while.
Something I was going to mention about the mismarketing of the movie. I agree it was stupid, but don't you think it's kind of interesting in its own way how it sort of reflects the propaganda theme of the film?
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was and you know what? It worked. It drew people to the theater thinking they were going to see one movie, and instead they saw a much better film.
Absolutely. I know that we've talked about... Oh, go ahead, Ethan. You have more to say.
No, I was going to let you talk.
Oh, okay. We've had discussions about whether this is his best film or not. I know that you, Barry, think that Pulp Fiction is a better film.
I do.
I think technically speaking, this is his... I can't... The cinematography, like in every single way, shape, and form, I think Tarantino stepped up his game for this film.
Mm-hmm.
I can see like the pulp and fun that Pulp Fiction has isn't in Inglourious Basterds. But I still think it's... I don't know. The more I think about it, I love Pulp Fiction. This is not a knock against Pulp Fiction. I know what I'm saying when I think that, you know, this is his best film that he's made yet. And it just blew my mind every time I've watched it. Like, he built suspense in this movie that, who knew that he could build suspense this way? Like, that opening scene in the farmhouse, or even when they're drinking, you know, who else would have the balls to do a half hour in a bar playing a card, you know, game, guess what historical figure I am, and make it compelling?
Yeah, that's a Hitchcock touch, to let the suspense build that long, but to let the scene play out honestly and let it be a character piece instead of it be like, okay, we need to like wrap this thing up. No, I mean, he lets it play out to the suspense is excruciating. That opening scene is one of the best scenes of the year.
Yeah, yeah. I love Inglourious Basterds. All right, what was your number nine, Ethan?
My number nine was Fantastic Mr. Fox. I've always been a big fan of Wes Anderson, and obviously some people felt his last few movies, he's kind of been moving into the dollhouse territory. I don't completely agree, but still, watching all his quirks and whims in this setting just kind of created something that's, it's just so tailor-made to kind of people like me, you know, people who are strange. And I just, the fact that this movie exists is just awesome. This hilarious stop motion animation movie with all the Beach Boys soundtrack. I love this movie. I think it's probably the funniest movie of the year, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree with you more. I totally agree. And to my shame, it's not on my top 10 list. To my absolute shame, it's the funniest movie of the year. And you know what? Like, I one of the things I wrote in my review, it's like, you know, 30 minutes into the movie, I'm like, who is this film for? I'm like, screw it. This movie is for me. He made this movie for me. It is this is exactly what it needs to be. It is a brilliant, brilliant film. I love The Life Aquatic, but I think this is his best film since Rushmore. It's just a total masterpiece.
And I'm ashamed I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, Dave, you gotta see it. You'll love it. You'll love it.
You're a cussing idiot.
Yeah.
Well done, sir.
I tried to watch as many movies as I could. I think I ended up breaking like 55 movies for 2009, which
good job.
For me wasn't that bad. But this is one of those I'm just like, man, I'm so bummed I didn't get to see it. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think you'll love it.
And my number nine is The Hurt Locker. I agree with Ethan in every... Have you brought it up yet, or was it you who brought
it? It was me. It was you who brought it up.
See, I'm tired.
Are we really that
interchangeable?
Interchangeable. I was just trying to see if I could insult you, Ethan. That's all. I think it's a powerful movie. I think this and Brothers. Brothers is, they're not the same movie, but they're a fascinating look at not about the war or the conflict in Iraq, but about the people behind it. And it was so powerful. I really enjoyed it all the way through. I mean, even though some of the characters are despicable and you're just like, what the heck's wrong with these people? It has the best executive decision cameo. That's really the only way I can describe that opening scene. It's a very powerful film that really lets you empathize with our soldiers over there. And it's so good. It rings true in so many ways. Yep. Even though I, you know, can't experience it, it's just so good.
Yep.
All right, let's just move on to number eight.
Number eight for me, another easy one, Up. The first 10 minutes of it were the best love story of the year, and what followed was a crazy, crazy, wildly inventive comedy about talking dogs and a crazy ostrich thing and dog fights and a giant balloon and this wonderful buddy comedy of these two very mismatched people. This is another milestone, absolute milestone for Pixar. This is one of the only Pixar movies I think I've seen I think I saw like three times in the theater. I loved Up. I think it's so crazy and goofy that I don't think it could possibly work as a live action movie. I think they had to do it this way. And I think
definitely
they went, you know, to use a cliche, I mean, sky's the limit. I think they absolutely just went for the moon and they got there.
What I love about the film is that they find Pixar. I mean, I'm not going to say this is as good as WALL-E, but because I love and adore WALL-E. But it seems like with just about every Pixar film, they find a way to hone their craft in some way. And they really dug into the emotional, like having an adult emotional story in that first 10 minutes. Like that alone gets it into top 10 lists. I mean, the rest of the movie could be complete crap. I mean, it could be Street Fighter. But that first 10 minutes, dude, it's amazing. It knocked me on my behind. I know kids don't probably, I actually started hearing stories about kids being bored during it. But I thought it was gripping and just amazing.
Well, I'm sure those kids love Transformers: Avengers: The Fallen, but we're bored out of their minds. And you know, and during Up, and you know, those are kids. Those won't be my kids. Let's just put it that way.
Those kids are assholes. Just put it that way.
You know, I'll say this. Up is character first. That's one of the reasons Up is so good. That's one of the reasons Fantastic Mr. Fox is so good. They establish the characters. You love the characters. You know the characters. You feel you understand these characters. One of the reasons that, you know, a movie like Monsters vs. Aliens will never be on this list, because that movie is fun and lovable, but it's pretty much about, you know, entertainment value. It's really not it's not skin deep. This movie is flesh and blood. You feel like you know these people, actually.
And there's nothing wrong with just having fun for fun's sake. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's not going to end up here.
This is another level of that.
Yeah. Ethan?
Number eight, we're at?
Yes.
Okay. My number eight is Two Lovers. This
good choice.
Movie, yeah, I remember I downloaded this movie, like, download, am I saying too much? In about April, I'd say, because I'd heard it was Joaquin Phoenix's last movie. I'm like, okay, I should see it
before he becomes a rapper.
And it sat on my laptop until about July. It was like July. I'm like, I should just get around to watching this movie. So I hit play, and I was just kind of softly blown away by it. I think it's a movie that's very patiently and slowly paced, but it's never boring. It really just lets you get into the characters, and I actually related to Joaquin Phoenix's character so much that it was kind of frightening at times, and I had to almost look away. But yeah, it's a very powerful movie. In a year of stuff like Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen, it makes you really appreciate the independent film, and yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful choice, sir. Thank you for bringing that up. I saw it at the 2008 Denver Film Festival. I really liked it. And then it got like a nothing release this year. Like, it kind of just came and went. I think this is one of Joaquin Phoenix's best performances. Boy, I totally understand what you mean, Ethan. Like, the parts where he's just kind of sitting in his hotel, in his apartment on his bed, and the window is open, and he's thinking about her. Like, oh, God, I can relate to that pain. I can relate to how he felt. Gwyneth Paltrow is so hot and cold for me, but I think she was terrific in this movie. And Vanessa Shaw, who's a lovely actress, she's been in everything from Ladybugs and Eyes Wide Shut, thought she was great in it too. This is James Gray, the guy who previously gave us We Own the Night, in addition to movies like The Yards. His movies, man, like, is one of the, you know, you don't always like his films, but I think it's easy to look at his movies and go, God, I know how that felt. He really makes you understand how the characters feel and the pain they're going through. And this wasn't always a fun movie to watch. I actually showed it to Julia, and she wasn't all that crazy about it. But I think it's an engrossing movie and an important film. I'm really glad you liked it.
Very cool. My number eight is the first of four movies that I saw at the Stars Denver Film Fest this year. And you know what, kids, get out your lucky crack pipe, because Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call of New Orleans, this movie was just fall down funny. Like, it took us about a half hour to figure out that this was supposed to be a comedy. But once you do, you can't help but have fun with this movie. It's just so out there. It made me want to watch more of Werner Herzog. And I can't even say how many movies I have in my Netflix watch instantly queue from him now, just because of that and Rescue Dawn. Two totally different films as far as tone goes. But Nicolas Cage, seriously, if Johnny Blaze was a crack fiend, Ghost Rider would have been such a better movie.
Nice.
In every way. Eva Mendes made up for Ghost Rider. I mean, there's not a weak performance in this film.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer is just odd. It's weird because he's just kind of there, but he's, you know, he does his job and gets, you know, the point across. But this movie rests solely on Nicolas Cage's shoulders, and he performs beautifully in it. Anytime you can play the fact that your dad and girlfriend are going to rehab as a joke, that takes some masterful handling there to be able to deal with that.
Yeah, seeing it a second time was an interesting experience for me because, you know, yes, it is a dark comedy first and foremost, but it's also a total mockery of the cop movie genre.
Oh, and the nice shiny bow that's put on at the end of the movie, you're like, where's this coming from?
Well, you know, minor spoiler. I mean, I think you can look at the end of the movie and wonder just how much of it's really happening and how much of it is from a crack pipe state of mind. And I think especially if you see, like, right before all the craziness happens in the climax of the movie, Exhibit and Nicolas Cage are smoking crack. So I think... Anyway,
okay, so he could be hallucinating the entire from there on out.
And I think the second time, I recommend seeing it again because for me it played even better because you see that there's not only is this movie a total goof, but I think there really was a lot going on in terms of making a movie about just the sad state of drug addiction. It's one of the most tragic love stories of the year. I mean, they play up the fact that Cage and Mendez had a really good relationship, and this is like the sad state of things. How terribly things have gone for this lovely couple.
Yes.
My problem, likewise, when I first saw the movie was that why does Val Kilmer have such a small role? But you know, Brad Dourif and Michael Shannon are also in the movie, and they also have small supporting roles. But they're all there basically to be part of the ensemble cast and to work with Herzog. And I think, I mean, even like Jennifer Coolidge, who is unrecognizable.
Oh my gosh!
She shines. Everybody's so good, and Kilmer really is good in his few scenes in the movie. It's just a smaller role. But
and let's not forget about the iguanas.
Let's not forget about the. Some soul dancing towards the end of the movie. Yeah, but you know, this is...
The soul dancing, like, you don't get just how brilliant that scene is in the trailer. You just see his soul still dancing. No, they show the soul dancing and it is glorious.
The way that scene plays and the way it's edited in the actual movie and the whole context of the scene, it is stunning and it's vaguely disturbing, too.
Oh, it totally is.
Yeah, and I think it's much higher up on my list than yours, but no, I agree with you. This is one of the great films. I think Cage found his Pulp Fiction. I think this is his Pulp Fiction, and I think this is one of the best things that Werner Herzog has ever done, and this is one of the great, great, great films of 2009 where the studio didn't have the budget to push this movie as much as it should have, because I think this thing is going to be a sensation on DVD.
Oh, yeah, people are going to discover this and...
They're going to go crazy about it. Yeah. I think Nicolas Cage is going to... I think this is going to be a huge, huge cult film for him.
Indeed.
That movie just missed my top 10. And I like that a lot of people are kind of focusing on the comedy aspects of it, but it is really a true Herzog film. Like, it totally has that theme of a flawed man stuck in a world that is both cruel and random.
Yeah.
And,
It's definitely random.
No, you're absolutely right, Ethan. Yeah, like a lot of Herzog movies is about a man who's trying to essentially like come back to the glory that he was once known for, you know, and he keeps getting in the way of himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, let's move on to number 7.
Number 7 for me was Clint Eastwood's Invictus, a film about rugby that made rugby absolutely thrilling. It's a sport I know very little about, but the movie was as violent and as exciting as it needed to be when it focused on rugby, and as involving and engaging and as thrilling as it needed to be when it focused on Nelson Mandela. Everything you've heard about Morgan Freeman's performance is true. It is gigantic. You can't take your eyes off of him. He becomes Mandela. There are scenes in the movie where it's either where the camera is focused or just how he... just happens to look, but Morgan Freeman essentially becomes Mandela. This is, I'd say, almost on the caliber of Denzel Washington and Malcolm X. You forget you're even watching an actor. He just becomes the character. And Matt Damon actually gives a performance that matches him. The two of them are so good. The camera lingers on the performances, which is really the way to go for a movie like this. It was criticized as being a little too slow and not being exciting enough. Those people, I think, are absolutely mad. I think this is one of the best films Clint Eastwood has done in a long time. Just a near perfect film. Absolutely inspiring.
Well, I guess I'm mad.
You didn't like it?
It was okay.
All right. Well, I love this film. I absolutely love it. I think this movie was genuinely inspiring and genuinely important in talking about the need for racial unity and racial harmony and for the need for us to put our past behind us and to go forward and to take pride in who we are, take pride in our race, take pride in who we are as a people and a shared experience and living on this planet. I think this is everything that The Blind Side was not.
Oh, dang. All right. What is your number 7, Ethan?
My number 7 is Where the Wild Things Are, and you know, audiences turned against this moving, emotionally honest, highly stylized children's fantasy, which will age well but was too out there for some, for adults and kids ready to deal with something richer than G-Force, Spike Jonze's Barry, read your writing for me. Film is a must-see.
Turn my words against me. What's that? What? There's a word you couldn't
inimitable.
Read. What?
Inimitable.
Yes.
Okay.
Inimitable.
You know, I think my editor must have changed whatever I wrote because that's a word I never use. So yeah, I think I think Jacob Schaefer, my editor at Maui Time, must have changed that because I never use that word because it's one of those words you can't help but trip up. Anyway, I totally agree with my review. Thank you for quoting it. I appreciate it.
Did you have anything else you wanted to say about it, Ethan? Or
anything that's not like from my mouth? Or
no, I found this movie to be completely emotionally brutal. Like like Two Lovers, I found it hard at times hard to watch because of how much I related to Max's childhood plight. And I like, again, this is one of those movies, like Fantastic Mr. Fox, you're just amazed it was made. And I mean that in a good way, not in a Transformers Revenge of the Fallen kind of way. Where it's like this high-budget movie about childhood angst with talking bears and chickens. It's just, yeah, I think it's a great film. And yeah, it'll definitely, as the years go on, it'll definitely be highly regarded.
I wholly agree. I think this is another Return to Oz. I think it's one of these movies that people weren't ready for or people just would not accept in theaters. But I think over time, people will relate to it and people understand it more. Yeah, I agree with you. At times, it's very hard to watch. I mean, the opening scene where Max is in his little snow fort and he gets hurt. It's like, man, I can relate to that. I'm sure variations of that have happened to me. It's hard sometimes when you watch a movie and you can relate to the performances. But I think that's one of the best things about movies. They can be personal. And Spike Jonze, God bless him, he took something that could have been such an easy children's film. He could have done such an easy cornball children's film, and he did something that was personal, it was risky, it was daring. And I don't think every choice he made in the movie worked, but yeah, this is one of the great ones. I really do think so.
Cool. And while I wasn't a big fan, I totally respect you guys liking it. I would never say anything bad about it. My number 7 is the first of 3 films that have zero studio backing on my list. Best Worst Movie is just such a joy.
Wonderful film. Wonderful.
As someone who had not seen Troll 2 before seeing this film, here is the mark of, it's difficult to make a film that's about, that isn't about such a highly regarded cult film. One of these movies that sets the standard for so bad it's good. But I never felt like I was being like, it wasn't like, you know, hey, look at this thing that we like and you have no clue about. It was, this thing is so awesome. We want to tell you about it and get you in on the joke and let you enjoy it, which it does. And then it turns into this really great story about George Hardy and who he is and how he's dealt with what it was and how the different stars have dealt with you know, ranging from people who still don't put the film on their resume to people who've just finally come, you know, like Michael Stevenson, who finally came around and has just embraced the cult following that this film has. It's just a fun movie that you can't help but have a smile on your face for most of the film. It's just so much fun. I believe that Michael Stevenson's working on getting a college tour going and to show, you know, a double feature of that, and Troll 2 followed it. And I can't, if it comes anywhere in Colorado, I will totally go to that double feature anytime.
Yeah.
That's, I already own Troll 2, so I will be buying this when it hits DVD so I can host my own little double features.
Nice, nice. No, I got to back you on that, buddy. Like, this fell out of my top 10, even my honorable mention, just because for me there were just so many good films this year. But I love this film. It's one of those documentaries I would compare it to American Movie. It has such affection for its characters. It is funny as heck. There is some sadness to it. There is a lot of truth to it. It is about how movies can be a collective experience of people just having fun. Let's make a movie together. It reminded me of Be Kind, Rewind in that sense. Mm-hmm. That joy of making a movie together, whether it's good or bad, who cares? We're making a movie. Yeah, I love this film. I just adored it.
Yes. And you haven't seen it yet, right, Ethan?
No, but I'm a big Troll 2 fan, so I'm definitely seeing it at some point the rest of my life.
I'm sure you'll enjoy it much. All right, let's move up to number 6.
Number 6, Spike Jonze's Where the Wild Things Are, for all the reasons that Ethan already mentioned.
Inimitable? Right. It's inimitable?
Inimitable. Inimitable, whatever the heck that means.
Indubitably. Yes. All right. And so you just move on from there. All right. What's your number 6, Ethan?
My number 6 is The Messenger. This is a movie that isn't like you were talking about Brothers or something and saying in mm-hmm. Hurt Locker, it's not the war. It's a movie that's not really about the war, but it's purely about characters. And I was expecting this movie to be, they're like this montage. Well, I guess I should, some people haven't heard of it, so I should say what's about. But it's about Ben Foster, who's this guy who's returning from Iraq, and he's kind of useless. So the army assigns him to deliver the bad news to the parents and loved ones of fallen soldiers, along with Woody Harrelson. And this is a movie, like, I expected it there to be like some montage of them delivering the news to people, but it shows you every single scene of in just pure, like, unedited glory, just them going and these people going through these emotions. And I think this movie says in 5 minutes what In the Valley of Allah tries to say in 2 hours.
Gotcha.
And yeah, okay. I found it extraordinarily powerful, and I think all the three performances, Ben Foster, Woody Harrelson, and Samantha Morton, are all knockouts. And yeah, it's a great kind of John Cassavetes-esque film. I highly recommend it.
Fantastic. I'd love to see it. It was here for 1 week, to our really? Shame. Oh, like, man. G-Force is still playing in some theaters here, but The Messenger was in Colorado Springs for 1 week. It's gone. So.
Well, and I can – it's interesting because, you know, that whole process, you say usually it'd be like a montage. I think that's not because it's a lack of storytelling. It's because you want – a lot of filmmakers want to let the viewers off the hook for that scene. And the fact that they go into depth on that, I'm very curious to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, my number six, you know, number six and number seven, it was very hard for me to choose between these two. This is my second film with zero studio backing, but you can watch it now. It is on Amazon's like print, you know, they'll make the copies on demand, and it's also for rent for like $3. But Official Rejection is an amazing look at the festival scene. I watched it for the third time last night at my poker game because our friend Nate was there, and I'm like, you need to see this movie, and he needs to watch it again, he said. But it's an honest look at the festival circuit, and while there is criticism of Sundance specifically and some pretty harsh criticism, there's also, you know, it's not just a bunch of whining and moaning. It's, all right, so you didn't get into Sundance, where do we go from here? And it's a very fascinating journey about where you're going to take your film and some places not to take your film. I still think that the Chicago Indie Fest is one of the most disturbing scenes I've ever seen in a film this year. Easily. I mean, like it, your heart sinks throughout this entire thing. It's just this calamity of unfortunate events just keeps building and building and building and building. And it's painful, but it's just so, and it's also funny. It's a funny movie. It's just good all over.
Yeah, absolutely. We were blessed to see some really fantastic documentaries at the fest this year. One of my favorites was Win or Lose, A Summer Camp Story, another movie that doesn't have any backing, but I hope it gets picked up by somebody because it's one of the funniest non-Judd Apatow comedies of the year. Win or Lose, A Summer Camp Story was brilliant. Official Rejection was fantastic. It's one of these movies that there were just so many great films that kind of slipped out of my top 10 list, but Official Rejection is a must. It is a must for people who are upcoming filmmakers, a must for people who just love movies.
Yeah, 2009 is such a good year. Like, I'm glad we have different lists.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different movies that need to be talked about and talked up. All right, so let's move up to number five.
That's easy for me. Number five is a film that I honestly thought would be one of my pick for best picture of the year if there weren't so many other good ones. But J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, for all the reasons we already mentioned, absolute masterpiece. Arguably the best movie to ever have the word Star Trek in the title. I love the film.
I think that's a fair argument. Ethan?
My number five is A Serious Man. This is a film that's very funny, very, very funny, but don't get me wrong. But like Barton Fink, I found it very haunting and disturbing and scary and existential at the same time. And I think it's a movie that really demands multiple viewings. I've only seen it the one time, but I can't wait to see it again and pick apart like all the symbolism and metaphors and such in the movie. And yeah, it's a great film.
I would be willing to see it again. I didn't like it at all. For me, it was a miserable movie about a miserable man, and I just did not dig it. I know that there are obvious biblical messages there, and I know, as you've mentioned, there is a great deal of symbolism there, and it's a very personal film for the Coen brothers. I felt such contempt for the people on screen and what they were going through. It's a movie that I kind of gave up on halfway through. I couldn't wait for it to be over. And perhaps, you know, I seriously will give this movie another shot. Perhaps maybe that was the idea. Maybe I was supposed to kind of go along with his journey and relate to his journey. But I could not wait for the film to be over. But you obviously had a very different experience watching it. I mean, did you find it captivating? Because I was so miserable watching this guy just watching, you know, him just the crap getting kicked out of him his whole life.
Well, seeing it at the premiere, North American premiere at the Toronto Film Festival with the Coen brothers in attendance, I guess, wasn't a miserable experience. But
nice.
No, but I was. It's like. Well, are you a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I am. Yeah.
Well, I kind of compare it to that a bit in that it's just so – just watching a guy get crapped on, you're like – and I empathize for Larry Gopnik so much. And I agree. It's, there's times you just like when I like cover your eyes. But I, again, all the everything going, all the deep themes of the movie kept me just so intrigued by it and wondering where it was going. And I think the final shot of the movie is just such a haunting image. I haven't been able to, even though I saw it in September, I haven't been able to get it out of my mind.
Hmm. Now, Dave, you liked this, A Serious Man?
I liked it. It's not my favorite Coen Brothers film by a long shot, but I definitely found a lot more humor in it than you did. Just the whole thing with Saul trying to comfort him as he's stealing his wife. Just, I can't help but laugh at that.
I didn't find that funny. I was like, oh, this movie. I just want to kill everyone on the screen except for Mr. Gopnik.
Well, and the whole, there's another Jew, son.
I think that was the point where the movie totally lost me. You know what I liked? I did like the opening sequence with Feivish Finkel playing the old man who comes in and that whole kind of ghost story. It seems like it's not related to the rest of the movie, but it is thematically. The movie pulled me in with that, and then I just thought, oh, I can't do this, but I will see it again.
Cool. All right, so it's to me, huh?
It sure is.
All right, my number five is Up. It's a great Pixar film. It's just so good. We've talked about it. I think we can just leave it at our previous discussion. So, number four.
Number four for me is the previously mentioned Werner Herzog's Bad Lieutenant, Protocol New Orleans, one of the soon-to-be midnight movie masterpieces that will be embraced for years to come. I highly recommend it for everybody. Even if you hate Nicolas Cage, give this movie a shot. It comes on DVD and Blu-ray in April. That is an event to be experienced. If you missed it in the theater, you missed out. This is a terrific movie. Please see it at all costs. Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
All right. Ethan, what is yours?
My number four is Up in the Air. This is a movie, I think, it's as much about George Clooney, or it's as much about America in general as it is about George Clooney's character. I think, obviously, you have the whole the corporate layoffs, that factor, and you have the interspersed interview. Like, it reminded me a lot of Warren Beatty's Reds.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
I thought that was awesome. But I think Clooney's character also represents a facet of America in which people are so alienated now by technology in the way that I think there's one scene in the movie that's subtle, but I found so powerful, where he's texting Vera Farmiga's character, and I'm thinking to myself, has our generation come to this where we can't just talk to each other? We have to text each other?
It's like in Hot Tub Time Machine.
Yeah.
That's right, I went there.
I'm looking forward to that. But I think this movie is extraordinarily powerful. And I think it is a movie for our time. And I know Barry was like, overrated. But
it sounded just like me, too.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's a great movie.
It's a film that's definitely grown on me as well. It's in my honorable mentions. And I wasn't the biggest fan when I saw it at the Denver Film Fest, but the performances are good. It's definitely grown on me a lot as I've been thinking about it since I saw it.
Overrated. No, it's a good film. It is a good movie, I'll admit. I just don't think it's one of the great movies of our time, but I did like the film. I love the performances, and if Anna Kendrick gets like a surprise Best Supporting Actress Academy Award, I'm totally in favor. I thought she was wonderful. And J.K. Simmons, man, knocked it out of the ballpark with that one scene. I thought he was terrific. Just what a great ensemble. And Jason Bateman, when did he become like one of the great character actors? I mean, this guy was in Teen Wolf 2, and he's amazing, amazing and Up in the Air. I mean, this guy is great. He can do anything.
Indeed, yes. Good film. It's one of these things, like, you know, even though it wasn't like top, like, I can't wait to see what Jason Reitman comes up with next.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, he's three movies in, and he's got a very distinguished career. I think, I'd say this is his best movie yet, I think. Yeah,
I think that's pretty fair. Yeah. Back to me again. My number four was An Education. This, for me, had the female performance of the year. Mm. I forget what the young lady's
name
is.
Carey Mulligan.
She was amazing in this because she found a way to have a character who is kind of pretentious. You know, but in a way that isn't, pretentious in the way that a teenage girl can be, especially when she starts getting into artsy stuff. And that's not to talk down about young girls, you know, girls as they're coming, you know, into who they are. Shut it. This is going
back. You're digging yourself into a hole. Oh,
you know, this is what happens when you do trauma interviews. You just, your mind gets warped for a few days afterwards. But she found a way to kind of have an innocence whilst being feeling, you know, pretending to be so worldly in knowledge and, oh, this and that and all this artistic stuff.
We all go through
exactly.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, to different extents. But I think she portrayed it in a beautiful way. Peter Sarsgaard was great.
Mm-hmm.
Just his reveal, like you had an idea what was coming. You didn't know it was going to unravel the way that it did, mm-hmm. reveal the way that it did.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's such a, it's truly a coming of age film. Like this yeah. girl learned about life with this story.
Mention Alfred Molina too.
Alfred Molina is so good as the dad. Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's not a weak performance in the film, I don't think.
Yeah, Emma Thompson was great. I thought the ending was a little too pat. Like the revelation yeah. comes out and it's like, oh, this is really terrible. And then she has like one of these, you know, you got to pick yourself up speeches. And then 2 minutes later, everything's okay. And then the movie ends. And I don't yeah. know. I don't know. Like it, for me, it made her sad journey. It didn't, it kind of took the sting out of it. But that said, yeah. I agree with you. The performances are great, completely, you know, completely recreated the 60s beautifully. And it was a really interesting time too, right before the counterculture revolution, back mm-hmm. when, you know, before like women's rights and, you know, before the counterculture went all crazy and no longer did teenagers have those kind of relationships with their parents. They were just putting a tie-dye going, screw you, mom, you don't get me. And they take off on a motorcycle and they go to Woodstock. You know, this is before that. And I loved that it captured that very distinct period before Flower Power.
Well, let me ask a question. I mean, it's kind of like, you can make a comparison. This is the only time I'm going to actually mention Precious during this interview, during this entire episode. But it's, you know, the other way you could have gone was to kind of have this super ambiguous, you don't know what's going to happen kind of thing with Precious. The difference is, I think that if they had gone that route with something much more, she's going to go off into life and who knows what's going to happen, I think it would have been, they could have gotten away with it a lot more than with aforementioned.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, I think I just wanted a little more movie. It just, it felt like yeah. they were trying to wrap it up or that there was more there and they just, I don't know. I mean, did you feel that, Ethan? Like, I just felt like
maybe
10 more
it's
minutes.
Like, and I think the actual scene where she discovers what Peter Sarsgaard is true to, I thought that scene was a little awkward, to be honest, and not in like good. I think the movie should have been about like 20 minutes longer.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know that, and I guess that's really saying something about the quality of the movie. I wanted it to be longer. I mean, how many movies can we say that about?
Yeah, no
I wanted it just to be a little longer, but it is a good film, no question.
Yeah, I think it's just amazing performances, and yeah, it was riveted the entire way through the film.
And Rosamund Pike, you know, a former Bond girl, she was great playing one of Sarsgaard's kind of hangers-on friends.
Yes, yeah, just so good. All right, so we are coming up to the top three.
Top three.
All right, what you got, Barry?
That's easy. Jamin Winans, Inc. What a surprise. Thank you, Dave, once again for introducing me to this movie. Seriously, I don't, like I was telling yesterday, I don't know if I would have found it otherwise. It played at Starfest this year. I didn't go to that screening. Dave did. He raved and ranted about it. I'm like, okay, I guess we'll give it a shot. Dave thinks it's so amazing. And it was. Incredible. One of the best action sequences of the year. In fact, I'd say three of the best action sequences of the year. One of the great plot twists of the year. It's and it actually is a plot twist where it actually builds up to it and it's honest. The movie leads up to it as opposed to like, let's just throw this in and blow their minds. No, it's actually a really well thought out story. Great fantasy film, great homegrown effects. For the most part, very good performances. I think the performance is probably my least favorite thing about it. Not a criticism, just an observation. This is only Winans' second movie, but I think once he breaks out with a huge third one, which I believe he will, I think people are going to go back and go, wow, look at this guy. He went from Ink to this movie. There clearly is a trajectory. He's a talent, absolute watch. I thought this was just a thrilling movie. Great experience. It's just one of these movies, like even watching it the second time, like it's just one of these movies where you just kind of forget where you are and you're just kind of taken along with it.
Yeah. You know, I've talked enough about it over the year that I'll just let your word stand.
We're fans of Ink over here.
Yes. What is your number three, Ethan?
My number three is underrated. The Limits of Control from Jim Jarmusch.
Wow.
Maybe this is a movie I like purely for superficial reasons, but I found its dreamy atmosphere to be pretty amazing, and it stayed with so many images and scenes just stayed with me. And I think it has there's some powerful subtext about it, about the relationship between man and art. Like I was talking about The Lovely Bones, I mean, we kind of had a knee-jerk reaction of hate. I think the same thing happened with this, and I think people just need to be lit when they watch movies and let themselves be consumed in an atmosphere and a mood. And yeah, I love this movie.
Wow, man, I'm so curious because I've not seen it. My brother Marty, whose opinion I respect a lot, he hated this movie more than anything I think he's seen in a while. He was like, Barry, don't see it. Don't even let Bill Murray sway you. Don't see this movie. But I like Jarmusch, and I think, and I agree with you, I think we tend to have a knee-jerk reaction, especially to his work, because his work is so strange, and it is so against the grain of what we expect. So no, I will definitely see it, if nothing else, completely on your recommendation. I'm very curious.
You're probably going to hate it and hate me.
Like, overrated. No, I'll see it. I'll see it. No, I promise. I will see it, and I'll be completely honest with you what I think. So.
And yep. Okay, my number three is Ink as well. And again, we've talked more than enough about it. I don't want to get into fatigue.
That's interesting. I didn't know it was tied at number three with you. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll just leave it there because I don't want to get into fatigue levels of talking of a movie. Okay. Let's move it to number two.
Number two, one that really surprised me. I mean, those are always the best ones where you go in with no expectations or your expectations are so bad. And then a movie just goes, surprise, I'm awesome. That's what I had with The Young Victoria. One of the lamest, most forgettable, and undistinguished trailers of the year. It looked like a total snooze fest. I don't like costume dramas. I think for the most part, more of them are like Elizabeth the Golden Years and The Other Bolin Girl than they are something good. I mean, seriously.
No. The Bolin Girl. No, the Golden Age. Did you say the Golden Years?
Did I?
He did.
Sorry. Yeah, Elizabeth the Golden Age. That's what it was called. The sequel to Elizabeth. I think most of these movies they suck because they're stiff, stiff performances, beautiful sets and costumes, but you don't know these characters. You don't care about these characters. You don't understand what they're going through. And really, it's just a big pageant. This movie I would compare to Braveheart. No, it's not an action movie, but it's one of these films where you understand what everybody's going through. You care about their journey. The movie is thrilling. It's so cinematically alive. It's so incredibly well done. The performances are terrific. You really do get what it's like to wake up in the morning and go, oh my God, I'm young. I rule this whole country and I have no idea what the heck I'm doing. It makes you understand what Victoria is going through, and you really like her. She's a really engaging character. Emily Blunt's performance is everything they've said it is. She's magnificent in this movie, but it's just a terrific cast. Mark Strong, who we've talked about before, plays a villain, surprise, surprise, in this, and he's excellent. Miranda Richardson is great. Jim Broadbent has one scene in the movie where he plays a king, and it's a literal party crashing scene, and he just brings down the house. He's fantastic. This is one of the great love stories of the year, but moreover, this is just, I would compare it to, like, in terms of just being a guy who is just very weary of movies that are like catered towards women or seemingly a chick flick. For me, this was like watching Anne of Green Gables or watching Pride and Prejudice. It was a movie that I brought my own prejudice to, and going out, I thought, oh crap, it's over. I loved it so much. I wanted it to keep going. I absolutely love this film. And seeing it a second time, like, yeah, this movie is a total masterpiece. Martin Scorsese was one of the executive producers, and it shows because it is as thrilling as any of his movies. I love this movie, and it's just like Bad Lieutenant. It's one of these movies that the studio doesn't have enough money to push it. And it went out there. This movie should be up for so many more Oscars. It should be making so much more money. But it's just kind of out there, and it'll vanish. But I hope it picks up a following on DVD and Blu-ray because it deserves to.
Would you compare it to Marie Antoinette? Because I love that movie.
I love Marie Antoinette, but this is very different. I like it more than Marie Antoinette just because I think the problem that a lot of people have with Marie Antoinette, as much as I love the film, I think it was a movie that people were very hard. It was hard for a lot of people to get into. I certainly found Marie Antoinette relatable, and I liked Kirsten Dunst's performance, but I think this movie goes further. I think you really relate to and understand and are engaged by Victoria's plight, whereas I think Marie Antoinette, I think people were kind of like, you know, she's kind of like she's kind of like an older version of like Britney Spears or Paris Hilton. She's just kind of a party girl who gets what she deserves. And I don't think people have that problem. I think people will find Young Victoria, the movie, and the character more engaging. But I really did love Marie Antoinette. But, you know, I think you and I are two of the few who did.
Okay.
All right. What's your number two, Ethan?
My number two is The Hurt Locker. This movie is proof that there can be an art house action movie. On one hand, you have these. The movie is littered with all these great set pieces, but every one ends up saying something about the main character played by Jeremy Renner. And it's a movie that the middle America audience can go and just like be riveted by. It's a movie that the latte sipping elitist can go to and be like, oh yes, this, and I found it, yeah, like I found it a great action film and a great character study at the same time, and I, Serious Man, the final image of the movie, both sad and powerful at the same time. So, yeah, it's a it deserves every it deserves all the praise that's been lavished on it.
Cool, so,
very good. Yeah, oh,
it's my turn. Dang it!
It is. What's wow, number
we're
just, two.
We're cranking through this.
We are.
This is an entirely different kind of number two because you know the worst of list. Then you're kind of saying, yeah, no, I don't know. I'm tired. You talk about CG in a lot of films this year. Avatar definitely established new things with CG. Mm-hmm. District 9 established fascinating uses of CG on a low budget. I would argue that it had better CG than a better use of CG than Avatar. However, when you let Terry Gilliam run loose with CG, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. The CG doesn't have that much to do with the film, honestly, but this is a movie that just really lets your imagination run wild. I can't imagine this movie with Heath Ledger through the entire film. That's how well that Terry Gilliam did.
Yeah.
Making this horrific thing that would have derailed 9 out of 10 movies. You know what? When you get your movies derailed on a regular basis, you find creative ways.
Yeah.
He made a way. He found a way to make this feel. Those changes feel very organic. Ledger's performance is great. Everyone who plays him, Jude Law, Johnny Depp, and Colin Farrell all do different performances and different aspects of Tony's character. It's probably the best way to put that. And they do it magnificently. Christopher Plummer's great as the titular character of Dr. Parnassus. Tom Waits is an awesome devil. Mm-hmm. Like, he's the devil in ways he's mustache twirling without being mustache twirling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
This is a movie I think no one's going to see because, again, this is one of those movies the studio doesn't have much budget to try to push it.
I'll tell you, again, it came out here 2 weeks ago, and I had a cold the weekend it came out, so I'm like, I'm not feeling too, I'll just see it next weekend. It left after 1 week.
And man, that's just so frustrating. I like to say it's like Brazil if it made sense. In some ways,
sense.
Well, you know what I mean. Yeah. You know what I mean. Just the fantastical, the true fantasy and fantastical elements of it. This is Gilliam's sandbox, and he really uses CG to as the tool that it should be, as opposed to the basis of the spectacle.
This is one of the most accessible Gilliam movies.
Easily.
You know, this is one of these movies where you tell a lot of people, like, go see this. You're going to love this. This is not on the level of The Wizard of Oz, but it's that kind of experience. It transports you. You will see things you've never seen before and things that you'll be so grateful you saw. But more than just the visual effects, as you indicated, the performances are so good. Christopher Plummer is fantastic.
Who would have thought? Vern Troyer.
Vern Troyer is wonderful. There's not a bad performance in it. And you know what? You're absolutely right. Like, this isn't one of these movies like Brainstorm or Poltergeist 3 where the death of one of the actresses in the movie, like, it obviously hurt the film, and obviously the movie cannot recover for it. They really did find a way to make it work and make it a love letter to Heath Ledger and really showcase his best work, but at the same time, the altered scenes where he's not in there work beautifully and quite well. Yeah, I think I don't want to say like such a step up, because I think for him it's always a step up. Gilliam is not playing in the same field as all these other directors. Gilliam is completely...
he's definitely his own man.
He's his own man, and he's done things in this movie that you could say, well, it's in line with Gilliam's other movies, yeah, but it's in line with his best films. The closing scenes where Parnassus has a different reality that he's in,
yes,
I thought were so powerful and so moving, and on the lines, anything on the lines of like Brazil or The Fisher King or Munchausen, this is a must-see movie.
Absolutely.
I totally agree with you. It just slipped out of my top 10, but I love the film too.
Absolutely. All right, let us move on to number one.
Dun, dun, dun. All right, well, you've heard me, excuse me, my cold. You've heard me lavish praise in this film a number of times, and I just love this film. And this is, you know, as much as I love the other films that have come out this year, there have been so many great films, this is one of the few I've seen more than once. And for me, it was just so clear and evident to me that this is a classic. This is a classic that people will discover. This is a classic that people will appreciate. There are a few critics who really latched onto it, but the fact that Public Enemies got released during the summertime and it was billed as this big action movie, I think really hurt it. Because it is so much more thoughtful. It is so much, there's so much more going on than simply a big shoot 'em up. Michael Mann's movie is a statement about the allure of getting away with it, the allure of living outside of the conventions, of obeying the law. This is a film about loving your celebrity and loving the bad things you're doing and getting away with it. the movie's act, the title, I think, is more a statement about the law, because really, John Dillinger, as played brilliantly by Johnny Depp, John Dillinger is essentially the hero of this movie. The bad guys are J. Edgar Hoover, and you've got Melvin Purvis, played very nicely, underplayed by Christian Bale in this movie. His character is essentially kind of in the middle. There's a great ensemble cast here. I mean, I know Stephen Lang is getting all the praise in the world for his work in Avatar. Stephen Lang is excellent in this movie. Marion Cotillard, certainly. Oh, shoot, what's his name? The guy who played Dr. Manhattan, Billy Crudup. Billy Crudup is excellent as J. Edgar Hoover. Not a bad performance, not a bad scene. We've talked many times about how great movies have these great sequences, or they're just a series of great sequences. This is one of the cases. There was not a bad scene in this movie. I know, Dave, you had you had problems with the cinematography, and a lot of people did, and that's totally valid. I didn't. I felt that, to me, it made this story universal, this story of this celebrity who loves the fact that he's a famous bad guy. We can say that about a lot of people in the news. For me, it made the story universal, and it put you completely into the action. I think the movie had more than enough action sequences, but moreover, it's a movie that made me care. It's an emotionally resilient story. Sorry, I'm using all these.
Whatever. Inipitant?
Inipitant?
Wait, what's the word?
Immaculate?
Wow.
Inevitable?
No, okay.
This is inevitable?
A little word. Engaging. This is such an engaging film, and like Heat, and like Miami Vice, not only does it have spectacular action sequences, but it has a really great love story at the heart of it that really sucked me in. I think this is best film than Heat. I think this is Mann's best film since Heat, and I think this is by far the best film of the year.
Very cool.
I liked it a lot too, and I think the kind of meh reaction from a lot of like the internet fanboys is proof that they hate subtlety, because I think all the characters in this movie are developed. It's just it's subtle. It's not them turning to the camera and saying, I feel this, I feel that. It's man, he builds a mood and atmosphere that evokes so many things. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Like, I love the cinematography of the movie. Just missed my top 10. Great movie. Actually, I slightly prefer Miami Vice, but yeah.
I love Miami Vice too. Thank you. Man, I swear, Ethan, like, you and I are the two people who really love Miami Vice, because nobody saw it, no one liked it, no one got it.
And I will be revisiting Public Enemies at some point. Absolutely.
Cool.
So, yes.
All right, so let's hear the rest of the ones.
Ethan, number one.
My number one is Inglourious Basterds. Well, this is a movie, I guess, with all the praise it's been lavished on it, we could say it's justly rated, but... this is a movie, like I said, about the limits of control, about the relationship between man and art, man and information, and I think the movie makes points that Funny Games tried to make, but again without the characters turning to the camera and explaining everything.
Dang. you were on the same page on this one, Ethan. This is my number one of the year as well.
Cool.
And
my favorite image of any movie this year is Shoshana preparing for the premiere as the David Bowie song plays, putting the Cat People song plays. I think an unforgettable cinematic image and sequence. Yeah.
What a bizarre, brilliantly perfect use of a song that most people completely forgot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure people have heard the Let's Dance version, but he used the actual version from the movie.
Yeah, and I love that version. That version, I believe, was up for a Golden Globe, but it's one of those Bowie songs that people, like, you know, his diehard fans know, but now people are like, oh, that's one of the great Bowie songs. And it is. It's because it's brilliantly used in this movie in a really brilliant, unusual way.
And what I love about it is, yes, we knew going into this, yes, we know the trailers were misleading, and we'd heard about all that, but I didn't expect this movie to be that good.
Yeah.
Who knew that I would be like enamored with a shot of a frickin' pastry? Like when they bring that pastry in, I'm just like, I'm not one who usually pays attention. Oh, go ahead.
Wait for the cream.
Yeah. Yes. It just the composition of that shot. I'm not one to go out looking for film composition. It just struck me as such a beautiful shot, and it's just kind of representative of how much Tarantino has grown as a filmmaker. And, you know, you could make I would say that, you know, Pulp Fiction is like his movie that he would make in his 20s, and this is like a film that he would make as a seasoned, you know, as he gets older and more mature. But it still had so much fun. It just gripped me in ways that I'm going to love this movie for years and years and years to come.
well, this is a movie in love with movies, you know, and that's the best type of film. You know, it doesn't pretend like it's the first of its type, because really at this point there can be no first of its type. Movies are over 100 years old. We're going to start recycling some of the same stories, but this movie is in love with new wave cinema. It is in love with World War II stories. It is in love with European film. I mean, there's so many aspects of cinema that are here, and it's a love letter to the glories of movies, what movies are possible, of the possibilities of films, and certainly like the whole notion of what happens in the climax of the movie is about how movies can be revenge. And yes. Movies can not only be escape against the enemy, but movies can destroy the enemy. And, you know, in a sense, you could say Tarantino is doing to Hitler in this movie what Mel Brooks has done to Hitler. Yes, it's fiction, but he is saying up yours, and he's getting the greatest revenge against Adolf Hitler that, you know, unfortunately humankind didn't get the chance to do. I'm sorry, you were saying, Ethan?
Well, I was just saying, well, he makes the point too that really propaganda skewers what we think is right and wrong, because the whole scene where the Bear Jew is firing at everyone obviously parallels the image of Frederick Zoller in the propaganda film firing off bullets and such. So he's making the point that just what we, you know, what propaganda leads us to believe is the good guys. Obviously, Germans, they were the bad guys, but I'm saying it's more complicated than that and such. And Tarantino's making that point, and yeah.
Yeah. Such a beautiful, I mean, it truly is a beautiful movie.
Whatever.
It's a movie that film buffs are going to just keep like dissecting and looking over again and again. And just plain movie lovers who just want to have a film, just watch a movie that is just so, it's such a fun ride. I think they'll go back to it again and again and again.
Well, and leave it to Tarantino to make a World War II movie where cinema saves the day. That's just a beautiful thing.
And you know what? One of the criticism against his work early on was that his movies were too violent. And maybe there is some truth to that, but not to this one. This movie is violent enough, I think. I think it's as violent as it needs to be.
Yeah.
Actually, the second time I watched the movie, I viewed it under the interpretation that the entire movie is Shoshana's dying dream as she's being tracked down by the Nazis, and it works perfectly that way too.
Wow.
So.
Interesting.
That would work very well. Absolutely. Wow. Oh, so good. We're running so long on time right now. You know what? Are there any honorable mentions that you absolutely have to talk about, or can we just
Antichrist?
Okay.
It was good.
All right.
Julie and Julia, the best so-called quote-unquote woman's film of the year. Smart, engaging, yeah, just really really wonderful, wonderful. Meryl Streep's performance was great. Just, a movie that just really expresses joy for what you love to do in life. And I love the film.
Very cool. I'm trying. Is there one on this list that I just absolutely have to bring up?
District 9 I didn't get to mention. I love that movie.
Yeah.
I whip it. You know, I just saw that recently, and it's just, again, it's one of these movies that's just so solidly put together and so much fun. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are plot holes you could drive a Mack truck through, but that's not the point of the movie. It's just a fun movie. And like you've said, Barry, it's a love letter to Austin, totally.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So fun movie.
All right. I'm going to cut it off here. I want to know what other people's favorite movies of the year are. I don't know that I needed a full top 10 or anything, but I'd love to know what people think about movies. But we have a voicemail and an email to get to this week. I feel so bad because this first email we got a couple weeks ago from Michael, and I just feel like an idiot for missing this. I will just read that, and then we have a very interesting voicemail that I'm sure we'll get a follow-up to in the next week or so. Anyhow, here's the email first. Hey, Screen Geeks, thanks for the great Firefly Serenity tribute on episode 98. I know, I'm behind in my podcast listening. It's okay, because we're behind in our email reading. So, yeah, turnabout and all that stuff. You okay over there, Ethan?
I'm leaving the room to charge my computer, so.
Oh, okay. Do you want us to pause?
No, continue on.
You asked about our experience in finding this wonderful show in our favorite episodes. I always feel like a bit of a Firefly snob in that I watched and recorded all the episodes off of Fox onto VHS. I was a huge fan of Buffy and Angel, so I was pretty much predisposed to give Firefly a shot and to love it. I will admit I fell for the show during the train job when Mal kicks the guy into the engine. That's such a great scene. Just a great moment, and hopefully I've not spoiled it for the others should you read this on the show. Again, we're talking about a show that's, what, 7 years old or so... It's all good. Anyway, I watched all the episodes as they aired, cursing Fox's stupid baseball postseason every time the show got moved or preempted. I was disappointed when the show got yanked from the airwaves, but I admit I treasured my VHS copies and showed them to people to get them hooked. I pre-ordered a set from Amazon as soon as I could to encourage the DVD set, and I recall going to Dragon Con the year after it aired and seeing bootlegs of the first season running around for a huge price tag. It was a great show. And as I watched, I found myself wondering if this was what audiences who discovered and loved classic Star Trek in the 60s must have felt like. Stunned that a genre show could be this entertaining. My favorite episode is probably Out of Gas, though I do love them all. I will say I think you guys are selling yourselves short by not at least giving Buffy a chance. Of course, it's my first Wheaton love, and I have a fanboy crush on Sarah Michelle Gellar, so that may explain a lot of it. And as part of it may have been watching it all unfold week in and week out. Season 2 may be the single most brilliant season I've seen in a long time on television, if only because Whedon foreshadows every development of the season in the season premiere. Plus the whole Buffy and Angel roller coaster that year with him going evil and her sending him to hell to end the season. Brilliance. Yes, I am a Whedon fan and I will watch anything the man does. Okay, I've blathered on far too long. Thanks for the great work. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Quick question, yes, Michael. If I watch Buffy, do I need to watch it in order, or are there certain episodes I should go to?
Well, you can ask me because I'm the fan.
But okay. Because I saw a few episodes, like, you know, in college, and I was not taken by it. I really just didn't like it.
Well, if you're watching like the middle of season 4 or something, and there's all these characters you know that haven't been established, and then it'd be kind of.
I remember the one about a demonically possessed cat, and I just thought, this is tired. I just didn't like it. And I saw the pilot, and I just wasn't taken by the pilot either.
The first season's a little, but trust me, once the show gets good, it gets good.
Okay, because I just wonder, like, is there a city on the edge of forever that I need to, like, go straight to, and that'll make me, like,
no,
completely...
It's the thing I like about the show is the characters, so it's watching them grow and such is what's really fun. So.
Okay.
Well, I'm hoping that this will be one of the series that gets put on Netflix Watch instantly as part of this whole deal with them delaying new releases. And if it is, I will absolutely put it in my queue and start watching, going through it.
Okay.
Yes, so I am willing to give it another shot.
Yeah, and I guess I should be too. I should be too. Yeah.
I know.
So, but thank you, Michael. And hey, good to know we have another brown coat on our team.
Indeed. All right, and then we have a very interesting email, as they always are if you listen to Geek Radio Daily. It's from Jabba.
Holy poop. I didn't know this was your phone number. I've been trying to call you guys for I don't even know how long. The number I had was 719-387-1804. And it never worked, and it wanted a password, and I'd make up stuff, and it'd be like, you have one attempt left. I don't know what was going on with that. But, wow, I can't believe this works. I'm not even prepared. I need to go get something to drink first. But it's about Predator, because you guys seriously missed the mark on Predator. All right, I'm going to have to re-listen to that show. I know it was 2 shows ago, but I'll be back.
Yes, folks, that is Jabba. We loves us some Jabba.
Well, holy poop. Thank you, Jabba, for that. That was great.
This isn't the first time I've heard that I just don't understand Predator.
You know what? And I'll be willing to admit, I think we were a little hard on Predator. I think it's easy to kind of overlook that it's a fun movie as opposed to looking at it and being kind of snobby like I certainly was. It's a fun movie. It really is. I enjoy Predator, even though it's not great art. So I think, no, you're right. We were probably a little too hard on it.
Well, you and Ethan were definitely more on the positive side of it than
I know. But
most of I were.
You know, it's one of these movies, like, if you had asked me, like, when I was 17, if I loved Predator, I'd be like, oh, yes, Predator. But, you know, now that I'm a little older, I think, I kind of turn my nose to it. But I shouldn't, because it's, you know, it is one of the, it's one of the better Schwarzenegger vehicles of the 80s. It is.
Yes. And Jabba just... I know you gave Ink a shot, but that's a movie you have to watch sober. I'm just saying. Give it a shot sober, and if you still don't like it, I appreciate you giving it a shot. That's all I got to say about that. So, yeah, it's all good. But anyhow, I totally forgot. We've still got theatrical releases to get through. What's coming out this week, sir?
This week, Mel Gibson returns in his first starring role in a long time.
Speaking of that movie, have you guys seen the clip from the original miniseries it's based on?
I saw the original miniseries like way back in the day with Brian Brown.
Yeah, but there's a certain clip I think you guys should see from it.
Okay.
Let me just get it.
They don't like reference like Mel Gibson, do they?
No, just watch this clip. I'm just saying I really hope it's in the movie.
Okay.
Okay, we'll watch it real quick and then be right back. And all I can say is curse you, sir. Wow.
Jeez.
Edge of Darkness in 5 seconds. That's all you need to know.
Strange how I don't remember that scene from the original.
All right, so we've got Edge of Darkness. What else have we got?
Edge of Darkness, starring Mel Gibson, by the way, directed by Martin Campbell, the guy who gave us Casino Royale and Goldeneye. Kristen Bell and When in Rome. Dave and I have actually heard good things about this, so maybe it's better than the average chick flick. Maybe it's just another January movie.
I'll find out. We decided I'm going to be the one to take that bullet. Potential bullet.
All right. Well, good luck, sir. And then a limited release, a film that Dave and I saw at the Denver Film Festival, St. John of Las Vegas, starring Steve Buscemi and Sarah Silverman.
Both of which, who knew Sarah Silverman could do that great?
It's a good, very good character performance by her. And if you love Steve Buscemi, you should see this. He is in top form in this movie.
Absolutely. And what we got on DVD?
DVD, Zombieland, one of our favorite movies of the year. I thought this was going to be in your top 10, honestly.
It was so close. It's definitely an honorable mention, but yeah. I gushed all over it after I first saw it, so I didn't need to bring it up again.
Okay, yeah, I love Zombieland too. Doctor Who, the complete specials.
It's
apparently not very special.
Half of them,
Dave,
are good and half of them suck. Yeah.
That sucks. Marinara's Amelia, which I've always wanted to see. It starred Hilary Swank and Richard Gere. Was in theaters for a very short period of time, so approach with caution. Planet Hulk.
Based off the comics, I'm looking forward to seeing this.
Yeah. Well, I love the comics, so I'm curious how that is. Adam, the charming romantic comedy about Asperger's syndrome.
Asperger's?
Yummy. I've heard good things about this. About the movie, I mean. Not about Asperger's.
Not about the Asperger's. Okay. Yeah.
That's what you had at last night at midnight, right?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I brought it all the way around. All right.
Good job, Dave. Ong Bak 2, The Beginning, starring Tony Jaa. Screw the plot. It's Tony Jaa flying around,
it's
kicking people in the face.
Movie. It's a video game movie.
Absolutely. It's Tony Jaa. I mean, like, you know. Tony Jaa is awesome. More Than a Game, the LeBron James documentary, which we've, again, heard good things about and haven't seen this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did like one screening like at 2 in the afternoon in the middle of the week. I'm like, well, if I could get off work, sure, but yeah.
Not nice. Universal Soldier, Regeneration, Jean-Claude Van Damme, very briefly, and Dolph Lundgren are back. This is supposed to be I've heard people say this is like the best in the series, so can it be?
Is that really saying much, though?
Well, you know, the Roland Emmerich original, I didn't think it was that great. So I hope this is a step up. It's just fun. I love that they made a sequel to this and that Lundgren and Van Damme are in it. So
yeah,
I'll see it for that reason alone. New York, I Love You.
But you're bringing me down.
I'm just really having a hard time working. It's got a short by Brett Ratner.
Well, apparently it had a short film in it done by Scarlett Johansson that they cut from the film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, sorry, ScarJo, not good enough. So,
I guess I'll rent it. I don't know.
I don't know. Because, yeah, the reviews were not, unlike Parish the Tim, which is something of a cousin to, the reviews for this have not been good at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I talked about Tokyo not being a fan of that either.
That's so, right. Yeah. Yeah, you know, sometimes anthology movies don't work, but I don't know.
Yeah.
The Wolfman, Universal Legacy Series. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder why that's being released.
I can't imagine why. I have no idea.
And then finally, supposedly one of the best in the genre of babysitting is really not the best career profession, House of the Devil with Udo Kier.
I'm so bummed. Yeah. I showed that at the Tivoli and we missed it.
I know.
I don't think Udo Kier is in it. It's Tom Noonan who's in it.
Udo's not in it?
No, uh-oh. It's Tom Noonan.
Oh, I'm sorry. The other weird genre guy, Tom Noonan, who I love Tom Noonan. He was Frankenstein in the Monster Squad.
Yeah.
Now I've got to look it up. Just because.
Oh, you think Udo's in it?
I don't know. Let's find out.
I could be totally, completely wrong. Wouldn't be the first time. Won't be the last time.
Let's see here.
But so. I'll always be right.
Wow. There it is.
House of the Devil.
Devil.
The Devil.
Wow. Okay. I could go Striper, but I'm not going to do that.
Striper.
Yeah, Tom Noonan.
Udo? Is Udo in it?
Nope, don't see him.
Barry's wrong.
Oh,
the human IMDb fails once again.
Have you got anything
looks
else?
Like I'll have, looks like I'll have to be teaching your film class now.
Oh
dang.
Well, good luck. Yeah. And then that's it. That's it for DVDs. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you'd like to shoot us an email, by all means, you can email us at podcastmelissa, Ethan, Barry, or Dave, all at screengeeks.com. And you can also give us a phone call at 719-553-5664. Jabba, I think you had an old number. I know I changed it at one point, so I do apologize for that, sir. But I'm glad you found us. Give us another call back, and I look forward to what you have to say about Predator.
Yes.
Should be interesting. But until next week, when we do Live Free or Die. No, not Live. Die Hard with a Vengeance. Good night. Vengeance.
I was supposed to say this. In addition to my cold, I will not be here for that. But hopefully Melissa will be here and Ethan will be here and be a good show.
Yeah, it will be much fun.
Wrap it up.
Yes, indeed. But until then, this is Dave.
This is Barry.
This is overrated.
Take it easy, everyone.